Welcome to Calibrate Conversations, a podcast about embracing God's standard for sexuality. I'm your host, Brady Cohn. Thank you so much for joining us today. Joining me today is our special guest, Linda from Minnesota. Linda, you were on a podcast a couple of years ago, and you kind of cringe, I know, when you think about recording that because you were really, really nervous and it was hard, but you have such an important story to share, and I'm so thankful for you being willing to share it back then. And then since then, you've contributed to our blog and you've been writing a couple of current things, and you really dive into the world of gender issues and transgenderism. You minister to moms whose kids are struggling, and you just provide so much hope and clarity and wisdom to a world that desperately needs it. And so we really, really appreciate you, and we're really excited to have you on today as we kind of dissect this story that someone is going to share.
Well, thank you for that very generous introduction, and thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So today we are going to watch a detransition story. Do you want to just explain for a minute, like, what does detransition even mean in this world of gender issues?
Sure. Well, we do hear a couple different things. We hear of the sisters, and that's usually an individual that will change course. They've taken on a new identity, but they find that that's not a path they've left before doing any medicalization. When we talk about a detransitioner, they've gone into something, either hormones, sometimes surgery. So we don't often hear the word desister, but there are quite a few of them out there. And as we've been hearing way more detransitioners now too.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, we're hearing a lot of stories from both. Probably we're less familiar with desisters because those are usually, obviously, it hasn't gotten as extreme. And so, you know, they haven't had all the surgeries, medical treatments. And so, thankfully, then it's a little bit easier process of going back. You know, I don't want to say easy. I don't think it's easy for any of them. But at least they haven't done things to their body yet. And so there isn't that barrier to going back to living how God created them to be.
Yeah, I think one thing I didn't point out in that is, with a person who desisted, they've often done a social transition. So they've gone through, the process of having everyone use their new name and their pronouns. And sometimes, too, they are doing things like binding, which can also leave some consequences, too. So there can be a lot to work through, even with desisters.
Absolutely. But we see that God continues to really restore and redeem his people. And, you know, I've said for a long time, I want the church to be ready for this moment, because when these transitioners come to the end of themselves and they realize that I've been sold a lie and this isn't actually helping me, we want to be ready to give them gospel hope.
Absolutely.
All right, so today we are watching this story of a detransitioner, Luke Healy. And so we're just going to play this entire interview. I really appreciate this podcast that interviewed him. And he really gives clarity and did a very good job of communicating a lot of aspects of transgenderism that you have studied in depth. And so we're just going to take what he says, and then we're going to make a bunch of pauses and kind of examine, and you can provide insight into these patterns and how you saw that play out in your own family's life as you were dealing with your son, and now you've ministered to hundreds of other parents. And so we just want to examine and explain what's going on, give some context, and understand some patterns happening in our culture here.
When we speak about evil, what exactly are we talking about?
Evil in general in our world today looks a lot like maybe more generally what you would call chaos. There's no rule or no social expectation or no moral that is not somehow oppressing someone from getting what they want. And if if some of these people have their way, I think eventually they will get rid of everything that does not immediately satisfy some base whim on the part of an individual, no matter how bad that is for society, no matter how bad that is for everyone involved. And I think that once you have a lack of that, you have just some kind of Babylonian abomination of what used to be America and our future.
Luke Healy is a good friend of mine and the first detransitioned male that I'm having on my show. So welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
So to, if you would mind introducing yourself to the viewers who may not know who you are, what your story is.
My name's Luke Healy, like you said. I'm from Stockton, California, and I was in various states of social and medical transitioning for about 10 to 11 years, 10 to 12 years. A little less than a year ago, I detransitioned and started living life as a male again.
What was it like growing up in the Central Valley for you?
As a young child, I think I had a time that many people would call like idyllic, right? I lived, my dad's a firefighter, so I had really close friends that were, you know, basically I had like 100 cousins, it felt like, right? And 30 uncles every day, you know what I mean? We lived out, you know, in just a very nice part of the Central Valley. You know, we spent our days bike riding, fishing, you know, things like that. You know, my brother played Little League a lot. I was less inclined in that area. But just really incredible times as a youth, and in a way that I think is sort of, I think it's somewhat, you know, unique. Being California, I think a lot of people think that we're either San Franciscans or we're...
Or from L.A.
Or from L.A., yeah, essentially. And growing up there, it was kind of that funny in-between where you're still a Californian. I think we have certain quirks that are unique to us. You know?
A little rural.
Yeah, but, you know, a little more rural, kind of more in common with maybe some places out, you know, in the South or in the Midwest.
But one thing I'd like to point out here is that Luke is saying how he had such a kind of great childhood. And I think that's worth pointing out because I think too many times we look at, you know, someone who's transitioned genders and, like, we're shocked because, like, oh, either they had a really good childhood, so, like, what went wrong, or we assume that it was, like, this horrible abusive situation that could have caused them to do something like that. You know, I have parents I minister to whose kids are, you know, gay, lesbian, all kinds of sexuality issues, and they have such a hard time. It's like, oh, well, it seems to have such a good childhood. It's like, well, having a good childhood doesn't mean that you're not a sinner and that you can't be deceived from something.
Yeah, I thought this was a good point to start with, too. You know, just in the 10 years that I've come alongside families, I've seen everything from, you know, solid homes to broken homes to religious homes to no faith at all, you know, religion, Republican, Democrat, you know, there's just as far as the homes that these kids come from, there's so much variation. So there's not like one thing you can look at and say, well, it's because of this particular thing.
Absolutely. And that should help, you know, give parents some grace. When I'm ministering to parents, there's always a balance of you're not responsible for your child's sin, especially your adult, you know, child and the life they're living. But there needs to be some humility. I was like, oh, maybe there were some unhealthy aspects of our family that, you know, God can reveal through this and we can learn and grow. And God's grace is big enough for us as a family to learn through this and walk humbly and examine ourselves while not feeling or being in a place of just, you know, taking on the guilt of our child's sin.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, places kind of like Nevada maybe or something like that. But, yeah, I mean, it was a really interesting, cool place to grow up as a kid.
What was your relationship like with your mom and dad and your family?
Before all this started, I had an amazing relationship with my mom and dad. My mom and dad split up when I was pretty young, but, you know, they still got along pretty well. And, you know, I had a unique relationship with my father and a unique relationship with my mother and a relationship with both of them. And, my little brother and I did what brothers do and fought a little bit, here and there before this stuff went on. But overall, and my older brother got along really well. So, I mean, you know, I had a great relationship with my family before a lot of this started and had this kind of, I don't want to say a postcard life, but, you know, pretty close to that, you know.
What started to lead to the descent towards this idea in your head that you were actually a girl rather than a young boy? What led up to that point?
Yeah. So I, you know, you and me have talked about this in other contexts before, but I think... exposure to the internet was one of the first kind of things. I began to feel very, at kind of a young age, I began to feel somewhat withdrawn from my, my male peers in particular and my family. We started to have some differences, right, in what our interests were as we were growing up. You know, I still like doing things with my dad and brother that I think are, you know, traditionally masculine, if you want to say that. I had a lot of, really good, role models in my life because of that. On the other hand, I think it's sort of like the preceding factor to some of these things. I did develop kind of an insecurity that I, you know, to the extent to which this was in my head, to which it was not, I think is, something I've argued with myself over, here and there, but, I felt like I wasn't like my peers in some sort of ineffable way, right? I didn't play sports. One big thing was I didn't socialize by playing sports because of a kind of issue I have with my eyes that makes it hard for me to track horizontal motion. That was really hard on me when I was a kid. And I just felt like I couldn't socialize properly with my with male peers in particular. I felt uncomfortable. I felt less than them. I felt less capable than them. You know, especially at physical activities, I just felt deeply insecure about my place in the world as a little boy.
All right, Linda, there's a lot that we could unpack here. So now here in his story, he's feeling some distress. He's feeling some insecurity. He's feeling that he can't relate to the other boys. Like maybe he's not one of them exactly, and or not included, accepted. And I've shared similar language so many times sharing my story, even though with me, it ended with, you know, same-sex attraction and not transgenderism. There's obviously, I can relate to that in so many ways of feeling this distress and discomfort. And so how do you see that in the lives of people who are dealing with transgender issues?
Yeah, one thing here is, you know, just the time on the internet, social media, the influences there, the distress, yes, almost always distress there, the ADHD and autism, different comorbidities that really make it a little more difficult to fit in with peers. So we tend to see actually quite a bit of that in the families when they express, you know, or when they share their child's story. The time on the internet, the withdrawing, I think is one of the things to really be looking out for. You know, if your child is beginning to withdraw, really be aware of what they're doing with that time, where they are, what they're looking at, because that's obviously one of the areas that ends up being a trap for these individuals that are very distressed.
Absolutely. You barely mentioned autism in there, and you know, I want to be really sensitive to our viewers. It's a hard topic for many families. Many families are having to work through that with their kids. What patterns have you seen there? It seems like maybe kids with autism are maybe a little more susceptible to some of these issues. And so, what have you seen with that?
Well, I think one with autism, you have the hyper focus, you know, that really focus on one thing. Not that they go directly to this, but they tend to have very specific interests. a good part of those interests take them to places where they're more prone to be pursued. So a lot of them will have interest in art. So there have been different web pages where they can go. There's DeviantArt. I'm trying to think of some other ones where autistic children would go to share, or with gaming. They found this gaming community to be an easy community to be in. So that ability or the ease of connecting with people online, I think made these individuals more vulnerable.
Yes. And deep down, we all want to feel like we belong, right? We want a sense of connection. And so when that belonging is interrupted with our peers and our family, and that interruption could be, you know, partially because of those, our peers and our family and dysfunction there, or it could be our own perceptions and the way that we perceive people and perceive the world, that we feel a sense of disconnection and not belonging and some distress there, insecurity. And then we really desperately want to belong somewhere. And sometimes we find that sense of belonging in sometime, you know, like this online community in the gaming world, or, you know, with art and creation and theater, and we crave for that sense of belonging. And some of those can be good things, and some of that sense of belonging can be real and good, but it's also prone for, you know, obviously predators, or you become hyper-focused on one thing and withdraw from other things. And so all good things can be misused. And so sometimes those ways of connecting with others are good things that can be overdone or misused or misplaced in our hearts, or sometimes they can be prone to be full of predators and bad influences, or just, you know, people who are blind, who are leading the blind then, who are kind of desperate for some type of identity and community.
And that was very troubling to me. But outside of that, living in the Central Valley was just an amazing way to grow up as a kid. And I wouldn't pick any other place to be a kid.
What did you initially learn about transgenderism then? Did it come from school? Was it from online or elsewhere?
So initially learning about transgenderism came through my engagement with the website Tumblr, and then with a friendship with a young woman in school at the time who was talking about a lot of these ideas and flirting with a lot of these ideas, whether it was, you know, outright transgenderism, or if it was homosexuality, or if it was the non-binary phenomenon of people not identifying as a man or a woman between that time. You know, having her as a friend definitely exposed me a lot to it, but also a lot of times on this website, kind of partaking in hobbies I really quite enjoyed. I would many times be in group chats and when conversation with adults who were propagating materials related to this and related to other mature themes up to, you know, outright pornography.
You know. Pornography. And you were seeing this at how old?
I'd say 11, 10 years old, I began to see this on the internet.
Yeah, this should be hopefully a wake-up call for all parents on what their kids are exposed to on the internet. It is not safe and it's not neutral. And I see a lot of parents where they say, like, oh, well, I don't want my kids to live in a bubble. I want them to learn how to navigate it. But they don't understand what their kids are being exposed to, and their kids don't have the maturity to walk away from that or limit it or process it in a healthy way.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I remember somebody saying that, you know, it's like just dropping your child off in the worst part of the city, you know, and leaving them there. You know, there's no limit to what they can be exposed to. And it seems that, you know, there's hardly any safe apps or safe social media sites, you know, TikTok, Instagram, you know, all of those have had ways that they've had predators come in and pursue, or just being exposed to content that is inappropriate.
absolutely. And he mentioned Tumblr. And I remember when Tumblr was a thing. I think it still is a thing. There's, you know, we've moved on to a lot of other different social media, but really all of them can be used in negative ways. There's secret messaging. There's just, you know, secret groups. There's, you know, with Snapchat, there's disappearing pictures that can be really enticing for kids. And then parents can't track what their kids are being exposed to. And there's just, there's predators lurking in all these places who are trying to convince our kids, that that's, an option for them. And, we need a lot more safeguards for our kids there.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, what you know mentioned before too, some of the hobbies, you know, going into and starting, my understanding is some of those really didn't have the private messaging, but it was kind of in those, chat spaces where they would get invited into places like Tumblr and then have those conversations. And once again, you know, thinking of a child who's autistic, you know, we know that they tend to gravitate towards people that are either younger or older. So, you know, meeting up with older people probably felt more comfortable than communicating with their peers as well.
Absolutely. And that's a recipe for kind of disaster there. And so, and I, you know, I agree with the sentiment. We want to teach our kids how to navigate the world and not just live in a bubble. But I think that the world out there in the internet is so much more harmful and addictive and exposure to things that most parents just have no idea. And so we can't be naive to that. And we need to be engaged with our kids and understanding where are they engaging? Where are they finding connection? You know, and we can't fix everything in our kids, but we need to be attempting to shepherd them and know them deeply and make sure that they're connecting in healthy places and understand how they're processing the world around them.
Yes, and I think parents, too, are, you know, very much opening up to, you know, the awareness is there now, and there have been efforts to come together. I think there is a wait until 8 movement that's starting right now where parents are trying to come together and sign an agreement that they're going to wait until 8th grade for their child to have a smartphone. So that it's not that your child's going to be the only one, you know, feel like they're left out of all the fun and connection. So seeing that happen has been an encouraging thing.
Absolutely.
Fairly regularly. Pretty early exposure.
Absolutely. I think it had a catastrophic, I think exposure to sexualization, pornography in particular, but sexualization in general was kind of maybe one of the earliest and one of the most decisive factors of my kind of slide into transgenderism.
And what exactly was the sexual content like? What was the extent of it?
I think it started out, so for some like kind of background, I guess, in some of my hobbies back then, I did an activity online called role-playing where people imitate various characters from various media, and they engage in, you know, fictional scenarios with one another where you write out your response of what my character does and what that character responds, right? And Tumblr had a ideal format for this back in the day. I don't know if it still does, but because you would have text and then you could put another text onto that, so it almost read like a piece of like a story almost, right? Because you could just go down and read it like that. I think when you reblogged it, it's called. But essentially, you know, over time, you know, I began to see, and like sometimes if people were either unaware of my age or didn't care, partake in sexual role-playing of that nature. And that also transformed into me starting to see, you know, it went into then visual depictions of these characters and of other things just drawn, you know, drawn pornography. Drawn pornography actually had a larger presence, especially early on, than actual photographic pornography. And I think...
And what was being depicted, exactly?
characters, especially from these medias, engaging in sexual intercourse of all kinds, you know.
What media are we talking about? Are we talking like cartoons or?
Cartoons, books that I was reading. You know, I was really into, trying to think of an example now. I was really into Pokemon, and you would see characters, you know, humanoid characters from that show and those, you know, mangas, I guess, and books and cards and all that. You would see them being portrayed having sexual intercourse, and then once you clicked on that, you would just see, you know, sort of random fictional pornography being drawn of just kind of two regular human beings. And the hole just kept getting deeper and deeper, right?
All right. I completely understand what he's talking about because I've seen all those things online. And so it's so tragic where you have kids who are interested in these cartoon characters and art, and that's a artistic expression for them. And, you know, they have this interest, and then that's what they find online. And like you said, it keeps taking them deeper and deeper into this just dark hole to where things that were interesting to them are now, you know, being graphically sexualized.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You said it well.
The pornography would become more twisted and twisted. And of course, eventually you start seeing just photographic pornography.
But the fact that it starts with children's media, and I assume like probably like even child characters, is pretty dark on its own.
Absolutely. There was incest depicted. There was sex between, you know, characters who are, I think it's been so long, but I think the word for it is canonically, you know, 15, 14 years old. Sex between people and what are fictional animals would take place. And I think there's a really big urge in people to kind of like downplay these things and think, oh, that's kind of funny, right? Like we laugh at furry kind of stuff, right? But there's very little to laugh about when you think about what the kind of like the bright colors and the characters that are being, you know, brought in, and the Venn diagram circle of this pornographic art, if you want to call it that, with children's media is not really funny at all.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Linda, I don't want people to write that off as just being something that's like very fringe or something unique that he ran into. It's like these types of just internet realities are everywhere and widespread. It's like there's one social media site, and I'm not going to name it because I don't want to give people ideas, but it's like there are groups there like that promote incest and will have like tens of thousands of people like sharing sexually graphic stories and fantasies about incest. There's this thing with bestiality. There's comics there that, you know, depict what would be child pornography, like, you know, sexualized pictures of kids, but it's legal if it's, you know, art and not an actual picture. And so that is widespread, and it's not something on the fringes. It's something that tens of thousands, millions of people are exposed to and engaged in, and it does really hook your heart and keeps getting you deeper and deeper into that.
Oh, absolutely. I had some time counseling teenagers as a lay counselor, just hearing stories and their exposures just was so troubling to think of, you know, almost traumatized, you know, by some of the things they would see and the impact that had on them and their beliefs. So, yeah, I don't think this is just a fringe thing, as you said. Talking to my daughter is Generation Z and her peers too, and just having some conversations with them about the content that they've stumbled on or that, you know, their peers talk about watching, and it's everywhere. To think that, you know, it is just that rare thing out there is you're being naive.
So you're interacting with other users on these forums who would talk about all these developmentally inappropriate things like pornography and eventually transgenderism. Were these people adults? Were they children?
It varied, but I would say the average age that I would talk to was 25. I think maybe up
average.
To I would say average. I think it's skewed younger in some cases, but it's skewed up to maybe 32 in other cases. Just people who don't have any business talking to kids that aren't theirs, or they're, you know, maybe they're little cousins or something like that. You know, I mean, just me nowadays being, you know, 24, which I don't consider all that old, but I have no real reason or desire to talk to even a 17-year-old on a social basis, you know, outside of people that are my immediate family or my, you know, my cousins or something like that. I mean, I just wouldn't have any purpose to do it. And so it's still mind-boggling looking back to me. It's still just, like, incomprehensible to me how you could go so far as not only want to talk to a 17-year-old or an 11-year-old about, you know, of any age under 18 or even 18 about, you know, sex or about pornography or about sexuality or gender or any of these things, how you could think that was okay. I would be terrified to have a conversation even approaching these topics with someone under the age of 18.
And how do you think learning about all those things affected you at such a young age?
I think it became a desensitization to immorality that would last much of the rest of my life up until now. I mean, I think I saw things and experienced things and did things, you know, in the real world that I would never have thought to without these exposures.
It was almost like a gateway drug, so to speak.
I think that's a way better analogy than one I could have thought of. I think that's exactly what it's like. It is a gateway drug into seeing it, to hearing it, to learning it, to doing it. And, you know, some of it is relatively mild, right? Like you learn, you know, strange cuss words that people say that you wouldn't have learned otherwise. I wouldn't have learned at my home otherwise. But when you start talking about exposure to graphic, vile sexual activity, you're talking about a downward slope into full harmful and, I would go so far as to say, degenerate behavior.
You know, Linda, one of the talking points of the LGBTQ community kind of agenda is that as kids discover these things, it's just awakening who they actually are. It's this self-discovery. They're discovering what's true about them. And I think that Luke's story and my own story and so many actually show that that's absolutely not true. It's actually making you into that. It is distorting your heart and making you desire and feel things that you wouldn't have otherwise. So this isn't discovering who you are. It's actually deceiving you into becoming and thinking you're someone that you're not supposed to be.
Yeah. And I, you know, thinking about, just the tools that are offered for young people that are questioning. I think that he makes a really good point here. You know, there's really no business, you know, having these older people, and why are they having these discussions with younger people? And something in just digging around that was really concerning to me. We have a representative here, Lee Finke in Minnesota, who published a book, and it's Queerfully and Wonderfully Made, a guide for LGBTQ Christian teens. And in there, the resources, one of them is for a website called Empty Closets. And on that, just right on the front, it says, everyone wonders who they are, but not everyone is brave enough to seek the answer. Empty Closets is a place where you can figure out who you are, surrounded by other people just like you, whether you're gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, curious, unsure, or a friend of someone who is. Empty Closets will help you find the answer. We welcome new members of all ages from 13 upward.
Oh, wow.
I went on here just to see, you know, look at what's happening on the website. And one of the first things that came up in there was someone asking for the visitors to describe their first sexual experience.
Oh, wow.
So I've heard things too about Trevor Project as well going on there. So there's no vetting as to who your kids are going to be talking to on those sites, because they open it up to anybody to come in. And so the chances of them being sexualized on those sites is very high.
Yes. I've heard of numerous programs where it's like this LGBTQ mentorship where, you know, kids sign up and it assigns you an adult LGBTQ person to mentor you with zero vetting. And no matter what, that's inappropriate. It's like they're mentoring them to be LGBTQ. And it's obviously, even if giving a few the benefit of the doubt, that they truly want to help a child not live in shame or something, no matter what, it's inappropriate at best, and at worst, it's absolutely full of predators. And I have no doubt that it's actually full of predators who are sexualizing the kids, having sexual conversations with the kids. Just the fact that this website would ask kids about their first sexual experience, and this is started by one of your state politicians, and that's how insane that world has gotten in how they are forcing sexuality on the kids. And they try to use this narrative of they're helping kids be themselves. It's like, no, you are creating them. You are leading them in this direction.
Well, yes, you know, the wording here, just curious, you know, check it out even if you're just curious.
Yeah, and we have the answer. It's like, well, every kid is looking for answers to something. And so they're enticing kids into that space.
How did that segue into transgenderism?
Segueing into transgenderism, I think coupled with the repeated exposure to it, with having these complications in my own life that I could not on my own bring resolution to, these solutions that were literally being pushed at me by adults of the explanation to all my problems. Well, why do you feel awkward around your family? And why do you feel awkward as a little boy? Or, you know, why are you having these problems, right? You can't explain them. Well, transgenderism seems to line up, right? You must be a woman, right? You don't like playing sports that much with your brother or as much as your brother, or with, you know, you don't like socializing with boys as much. You must be a woman, right? Look at like this idea of like, look at men, like they're so boring and so stupid and so brutal and so awful towards women, like women. How could you be that, right? I mean, that was just repeated ideas. And then,
all right, there's a couple things that we could unpack there. One is that we need to be careful with just gender stereotypes and putting gender into a box to where boys feel excluded from manhood if they're not big into, you know, sports and cars and so forth. And I know so many men who went down the road of same-sex attraction where there's this gap between them and other men where they felt like they don't belong because they didn't fit the stereotypical box. And then same with, you know, girls. Like, it used to be – it was okay for a girl to be a tomboy where, you know, she was kind of rough and into sports and not, like, super feminine. And that was completely fine and good. And they grew up to be healthy, strong women. And now all these kids are put in a box like, oh, if you're a girl who likes this, then you must actually be a boy and you're actually trans. Or if you're a boy who doesn't like sports and cars, then you might actually be a girl. And so I'd be careful about those gender stereotypes. But then something else he said here that I thought is so relevant to our culture right now is like it is looked down upon to be a man because men are abusive and oppressive. And I think there's so many younger kids like middle school age where boys are trying to escape being male because especially being a white male means that you're oppressive. And they want to try to escape that.
These solutions that were literally being pushed at me by adults of the explanation to all my problems. Well, why do you feel awkward around your family? And why do you feel awkward as a little boy? Or, you know, why are you having these problems, right? You can't explain them. Well, transgenderism seems to line up, right? You must be a woman, right? You don't like playing sports that much with your brother or as much as your brother, or with, you know, you don't like socializing with boys as much. You must be a woman, right? Look at like this idea of like, look at men, like they're so boring and so stupid and so brutal and so awful towards women, like women. How could you be that?
Linda, there's a couple of different things we could talk about here. One is that we have to be careful with the gender stereotypes we perpetuate so many times of, like, you know, a boy has to be into cars and sports, and we make them feel excluded if they not into that as much as other boys. And so as we need to be speaking healthy identity and value into our boys and not put them into these boxes. And same thing with girls. We, you know, it used to be that it was completely okay for girls to, you know, be a tomboy to where she wasn't as feminine, and now should be labeled as like transgender or non-binary and cause so much confusion instead of just embracing that she's not exactly like every girl. And that'd be really boring if we were all exactly like one another. And so we need to be cautious of that. And then he's also speaking, you know, about how it's really looked down upon in our culture to be a man, and to, especially to be a white man. And so there's so many younger kids, like, you know, teenage boys, especially if you're a white boy, of like, oh, I'm the oppressor. That's the narrative. And so I need to not be that, and I need to escape from being a white man. And transgenderism is one way that they can do that.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, as you said, culture too, and he brings up porn, when you think about how men and women are depicted in that, you can see where a man would not, you know, want to be, you know, there are men that wouldn't want to be part of that either. When you're young at, you know, and exposed at this point, and you see this is what a man is, same as a young lady, to be exposed to porn and see these depictions of what a woman is, you can see where they would be very troubled and confused by that identity.
Absolutely. And we're all looking to escape our problems. And so we as parents need to be very vigilant on what distress our kids feeling, and why are they feeling that. And, like, we can't all be a, you know, like, I don't want to put too much pressure on parents. It's like none of us are perfect, and it's impossible to completely understand each and every one of our kids. But we try, and we try to understand what distress are they feeling, and how can we give them healthy connection and not feel a need to escape to somewhere, like, you know, all the stuff that's happening online.
Absolutely.
You've raised six kids now, and so you've been through the drill a few times.
Oh, definitely. And then they're all very different. So, you know, it's not like we figured out a formula with number one and we could just carry that down the line.
Yes. Some of that is having to trust the Holy Spirit to work and God to move in their life, and helping them have a stability with their relationship with God, so that it's not this self-discovery project every day to figure out who they are, but they allow the Lord to form them and give them their identity.
Female friend of mine, if I remember correctly, came out as non-binary initially, and then later on would come out as a transgender man. And that was sort of my, that was my broader exposure to this idea, and sort of like very intimately close to me.
And this was a girl from school, or was she from the
internet? Yeah, she went to school with me. She, if I remember right, she transferred into our school from somewhere else. So, yeah, she was sort of like a, I don't really know if you call things at that age a romantic interest, you know, but I mean, she was a girl that I liked, you know, but we kind of like bounced between that and just, you know, being friends and, you know, just kids basically. But definitely we were both trying to talk about things that were outside of my normal scope of life, for sure, or anything I had really experienced before, you know.
When did it get to the point that you started to personally connect it to yourself and question it?
I think I started to develop this idea. I don't want to say I developed the idea. I think I absorbed the idea that there is this caricature of maleness and of boys and men that is like brutish and oppressive and stale and boring and all these things, these negative archetypes, right, that I couldn't possibly like be, right, myself, right? That was my thought. You know, and it's kind of funny. I'm talking about, you know, where I'm from. I started kind of feeling the same way about my hometown at the same time, right? It's sort of a weird connection, I suppose, but it was sort of like, if I was a man from where I was from, I was going to be this kind of like brutish, backwater, awful to women person forever. You know what I mean? That was kind of, that was what I began to feel. And so.
Was that what you saw out of like some of your, you know, role models growing up?
I don't think so. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think these ideas are so twisted and delivered so manipulatively online that despite, like, you know, my dad's never been that way. Very few males in my life have ever been that way. Certainly not my brothers. I think the only thing in person that shifted with them was they were, you know, they were a little more outgoing than I was. But I think these people on the internet that kind of had these kind of like man-hating ideas, they twisted that kind of like basic uncomfortable feeling within me into a hatred for myself and a hatred for men in general.
I think that's a powerful statement there. And I think it's a reminder that, you know, we can develop lenses in which we see things and we actually start to see them less clearly. And, one of the statements I hate in our culture is that, perception is reality. It's like, no, like what you're perceiving is not necessarily reality. Like our perception lies to us and it leads us astray. And so he started to see, his environment and his people and his town and manhood through this certain lens that men are evil and kind of reading way more into it than was there when he looked at how his dad, his brothers and other men behaved. And so our perception is not always reality. It might be our reality, but that doesn't mean that it's the truth. And I think that we see that with a lot of our kids who are struggling. On all of a sudden, they're looking at their childhoods and their families from a completely different light through this lens of a narrative that's being fed to them. How have you seen that in the lives of a lot of the families you minister to?
Oh, it's universal, really. I like that he made the correction, you know, and he said absorbed, because there, I think that's a really big part of it. You start to realize that, it's an entire belief system. It's not just about this gender dysphoria that they're saying. It's all encompassing of this belief system, you know, that of oppression. And, so, you know, especially Christian families that, you know, if there's any authority, well, that's oppressive. And, you know, he talked about his upbringing. So there's so many areas there where parents would say they seemed very content and happy in. And now it's like they're rewriting and speaking of how this upbringing was so oppressive.
Yes. I've seen that in the lives of a lot of families, to where all of a sudden their adult transgender child or their kid with, you know, same-sex attraction, just living the lifestyle, it's just believing this narrative that your family is hateful and oppressive. And it's so hard where it's like, you don't actually know what's always going on behind closed doors. And sometimes there are really unhealthy family dynamics that parents are denying, and parents need their own discipleship to help them sort things out and see things clearly and realize that maybe there were some really unhealthy family dynamics. Sometimes maybe abusive, but that's a strong word. That's not always the case, but sometimes just unhealthy. But many times their child is seeing something through a completely different lens that is being fed to them, that you're assuming that your family hates you, that your family is oppressive, and you start believing that because it's these people that have gained so much influence over you that you believe this narrative and you start finding your identity in this narrative and you just run with it. And in our parents group, we kind of joke about it a lot of times, but it's this serious thing where for some of those transgender kids, like all logic has gone out the window. And their kids will say things like, that makes no sense, and it's not grounded in reality, and that's not what you actually experienced as a child. And as a parent, I know you didn't experience that, and yet you've been convinced that you did. And where is this coming from? And it just is as if history is being rewritten in this child's life.
No, absolutely. We see, you know, we've talked about the script. As new parents would come in our support group, and the parents would, you know, just give a short overview, telling of their story, and, you know, just seeing the newcomers and kind of the look on their face because they're hearing their story, you know, thinking how, you know, how can it be that your child, you know, is saying they experienced the same thing as mine, and, you know, none of them have had those experiences. So it's been that part has been so common. Yet I like, you know, what you said too. You do need to really take into consideration everyone's story, because there are times where some of these kids are coming from very abusive homes. We've had some in our house who, you know, are living, you know, would be living with their grandparents, but the story of their childhood and their experiences in their home with their parents have been very difficult. So, you know, we really want to be listening to the child and to the young adult or whoever, you know, hearing their story and their background, you know, knowing that there definitely can be truth in there.
Yes, and that's a hard thing we navigate, and I think we should have a spiritual perspective of our heart is deceitful, and every heart can twist things and believe things that aren't true and have different perceptions. And so we listen to people's stories and we show empathy while not assuming that everything they're saying is true. And they could be maliciously, intentionally lying, or they could just be deceived in reading a narrative into their story. And, you know, we can understand that biblically and understand that people are deceived. And so we don't go into those conversations assuming that they're being dishonest and they're lying and sharing their story. But no, we listen and we try to understand and we try to but we have the assumption that not everything they're saying is actually factual or true, whether they're maliciously, intentionally trying to deceive us or their perception has been skewed.
Right.
And then to a point where it was like, well, I can't be that, right? Because I feel this and this and this, and I'm more like these, you know, compatriots of mine that I have online than I am anyone I know in person. So what must be wrong with me? And then that question led to, you know, first identifying as non-binary, like not a man or a woman, just like, you know, kind of in between in that ideology sort of definition.
And how did you go about that? What did that look like?
I basically just called myself a different name, you know, like I wanted to, I very seldom like cross-dressed while I was younger because I didn't want to, in my mind, disappoint my parents or embarrass myself or draw attention to myself.
Did you feel any guilt about how your mom and dad might have felt about this?
Yeah, I definitely didn't want to, I didn't want to let my dad down. You know, I love my dad. You know, him and I went through some really hard times through this, but I always loved my dad, you know. I didn't want them to feel like I was doing something wrong to them. But so with, like, the non-binary thing, you know, that was the initial, I went by a different name. And then later on it developed into, like, this sort of desire to be all the way, if that makes sense, or like feeling like I wasn't in between. I was just 100% not male. I couldn't be male, right? I had to be a female, I suppose.
And how old were you at this point in time? How old were you when you started learning about this, and then once you actually decided to go into this lifestyle?
So when I was 11 years old, I was definitely learning about this stuff and getting into it and getting more immersed, but I was somewhat private about it outside of between me and that aforementioned friend I had in school and the, you know, my friends on the internet, all these adults.
Linda, I think it's worth pointing out that I see this being really typical where it's this gradual process of, you know, he started out as non-binary and kind of going by a different name, but before it became full-fledged transgenderism. And I think that's typical. It's like someone is kind of testing the waters and they think like, oh, I can dabble in this a little bit and it's giving me a little bit of relief. It feels like, but then they have to, eventually they feel like they have to go all the way. And it's kind of starts out this in between gradual minor and then just ends up completely captivating them.
Yeah, that's been what I've been hearing too. It's more of a progression, you know, this idea of being trapped in the wrong body and always feeling this way. You know, most of the time when you hear more so from the detransitioners, I think, you know, we're hearing these stories when they tell the about the process, how this happened. You hear that there has been that progression, starting out with bi or just these different areas that they're experimenting with. And once again, just the telling of looking for solutions for distress.
Mm-hmm. On the internet coaching me sort of. But I came out to my parents when I was around 13 years old. I think very freshly 13 years old, I kind of told my parents, you know, I told my parents that I was a different sexuality and a different gender than I was assigned, or I was female and not male.
How did that play out? What did you tell them?
I was so nervous and, like, overwhelmed with, I think, confusion, really. I think kind of like, I think there was always a part of me, like, kind of yammering at this slowly kind of, like, growing cloud over me, like, saying, like, this isn't right, you know, but I went there with like a post note or a piece of paper or something that like wrote down exactly what I wanted to say. And I said, you know, I'm a, the word sounds so strange now, but I'm a pansexual transgender female and I want you to call me this and, you know, so on and so forth. Right. And they reacted, I think, with some panic and some like real bewilderment of how far into this I had gone, you know? I mean, they knew I was maturing, I think, a little too fast. Maybe not maturing, but I was getting into a maturity level too fast, and they or false maturity, I would say. And they were noticing that, but I don't think they had even estimated how far gone I had fallen into this whole world.
Linda, this is a terrifying moment for parents, and you know, I've seen parents who respond in these moments in very unhelpful ways, ways that I would probably say are sinful. However, there's so many parents where it's like it's just mind blowing and devastating, and I want to give so much grace and the fact that it's so unknown and just shocking that no parent is prepared for a moment where their 13-year-old says that I'm actually a woman or a girl and I need to go by this name and I'm pansexual. It's like that isn't in the playbook of or the manual that our newborn babies come home from the hospital with on what's going to happen at some point.
Right. Yeah. The reactions vary quite a bit. I know. I think he still has yet to share his mom's response, and I could relate to that. I too, kind of being a medical person, and we had we already had dealt with so many different health issues with our son, and we knew there was distress there too. So for me, there was almost a little bit of relief, at least that he was expressing what he was going through, since he had made efforts before. So I too just, you know, will hear wanted to really try to understand what was going on and really happy that he was communicating with me.
Yes.
So what was their reaction? How did they react after this?
My dad seemed angry at the time, but I think he was distraught. There were a lot of like questions he posed to me about, you know, we did all these things together when you were a kid, so do these things not matter anymore? You know, and that was heartbreaking. My mom was very, my mom was just bewildered, you know. She was trying to understand, you know, to be compassionate, to be, you know, in her mind, open-minded and kind, but just really confused, you know. I mean, again, I think the overwhelming feelings that they were experiencing were just shock and maybe despair at how much exposure I was getting to these kind of ideas.
How did that affect your relationship with them over time?
I think at risk of sounding melodramatic, it destroyed my relationship with them over time, particularly with my father. The animosity that I was and the enmity that I was told to basically, that I think in a way I was instructed to develop between myself and my parents for what they had done to me, so to speak, by denying me medication as a child and not, you know, affirming and things like that, right? Or at least with my mom wanting to slow down, at least research this because, you know, she didn't know much about it.
Which is kind of a sensible reaction for a parent who doesn't really know anything about this. I mean, where did you get those beliefs from that you were being denied?
You know, just like these internet, you know, peers and adults. I mean, again, this, you know, one of the big emphasis that I have when I tell people, or emphases that I have when I tell people about these things is that the amount of adult coaching into these ideas that I had to have to go through with these thoughts and these actions towards my parents is it's astronomical. I mean, you know, a lot of these thoughts were put in my brain like, oh, your parents were so bad to you for doing this to you. Like they're so, you know, oppressive or this or that, you know. And you know, I was basically taught that my parents must hate me because of this, right? My parents must be just bigoted and, you know, wrong and whatever. So more and more I was just absorbed by this, I don't want to say hatred of my parents, but like this deep distrust and sadness towards them of, well, you're hurting me, right? But like little did I know they were doing these, you know, these like passionate kind of like feats in my favor to protect me from something that was going to destroy my body and my mind and my soul, and did, you know, to some extent.
Yeah, Linda, this is so heartbreaking. And we've seen this play out so many times where these kids are being fed a narrative of your parents hate you and your parents are denying you and they're being oppressive. And it is this script from adults that is speaking this into the kids and helping kids intentionally develop an animosity towards their parents.
Oh, absolutely. It's such a flip. You know, there'll be so many parents that'll talk about the beautiful relationship they had with their child, very open relationship. And, you know, just to see things turn in this way and the accusations that come. I remember, you know, I had a very close relationship with our son. You know, because he was autistic and he needed help, I would go every week to help him grocery shop and, you know, whatever assistance he needed and things. And we always ended every visit with a hug and things seemed to be going very well. But I remember at a certain point, I was actually visiting with our pastor at the time and a text came through and I read it and just showed our pastor and said, this doesn't even look like our son. This is crazy. Like, this isn't even like him. This isn't his character to communicate this way. So it really, to us at least, it seems sudden. I don't know how much, you know, as, you know, Luke said here, that had to be said, you know, repeatedly for them to believe these things about their parents. But as a parent, it does feel like it's just a real sudden flip.
Absolutely. And I think there's, you know, I hope I haven't been too hard on parents over the years with the most my speaking on these issues has been on the sexuality aspect. And many times, you know, with sexuality, kids have been struggling for years. And the way that it was talked about in the home wasn't a very healthy way about how, like, oh, we talk about those people. And so the child was sitting there for years struggling with this inner turmoil with same-sex attraction and couldn't talk about it because of how it was talked about. So, like, we want to take responsibility as in how we talk about these issues as a family. But I see it even more so with the transgender issues of it does develop so suddenly, whereas with sexuality, it seems like, you know, usually from puberty on, like kids have started to develop some same-sex attraction. But with sexuality, it's an idea that is presented to them that is a solution to whatever problems they're facing, and it does develop so quickly that then when it comes out, parents are caught so off guard, and kids are so scripted on how they should be viewing then their parents, their family, and it's just devastating.
Yeah, I think you know, Lisa Littman can be credited for that. You know, the ROGD, the rapid onset gender dysphoria, and then Abigail Schreier, you know, putting out the book Irreversible Damage. I think for it was a gift to many parents to hear somebody that understood it. But yeah, definitely, it's the reason there's so much shock, and you can understand why sometimes parents do respond in anger because they do just get blindsided. And you know, we know that anger is a secondary, you know, response. So, you know, what is the first one? It's often fear and shock and, you know, just the different emotions they're going through in that moment, not really seeing it come. And in our case, it came not only the announcement, but it came with pretty much a demand that we would help medicalize our child. So, you know, here in 2014, when we hadn't heard anything about it and we're told that I'm no longer your son, but I'm your daughter, and I need you to help me transition, and also, you know, hand me the first bill to the endocrinologist that someone got him to. So, you know, there was just so much that came to, you know, at us out of nowhere.
Yes, and I think that there's not ever going to be a perfect response from parents because no response is going to undo the deception, right? And so there's so much brokenness and deception already in these situations that no response is going to undo that. So we want, obviously, parents to have a spirit-filled, not to freak out, not to, you know, respond in anger, but there should be a deep amount of, obviously, concern, questioning, trying to understand what's going on. But then that is perceived and it's accused of, like, you're denying what they need and you're supposed to instantly go along with this. And, you know, there's even a bill in Colorado now that they're trying to pass that if you, quote, dead name your child, which is going by their birth name, you will have – your child will be removed from your home, and it's considered child abuse. And so what a just insane world we're living in when we see the consequences. And we should probably just keep listening to Luke's story because we'll see kind of what the consequences were of this ideology that was being pushed on him.
I mean, for your mom and dad, like, that seems like such a dilemma for them. Like, it's clear, I think it shows that through their actions that they loved you and they cared for you and they wanted what was best for you, but that clashed with your desires at the time. So when you were talking with these other accounts, and especially with these other adults, about these ideas, the sexualization, about gender, Did they try to facilitate actual real life relationships with you?
That's a great question. Initially, no. Initially, you know, this aforementioned female that I talked about earlier, who I met in elementary school, we had kind of a, you know, we never had any sexual contact with each other, but we had, you know, we did things that I think are somewhat developmentally typical for, you know, boys and girls at that age, like around 13 and stuff do. I mean, we kissed each other at one point, things like that. But other people who were in these kind of ideas were doing things like, there was, when I was 11 years old, a 16-year-old trans-identified female was found by my stepdad outside of my window while texting me in the middle of the night. So another minor, but just not really an appropriate age gap or an appropriate behavior. And then...
She was staring into your room or what?
While texting me, yeah.
How did she find your address?
We lived in the same neighborhood at the time. So we would actually, that other person, them would actually walk around the neighborhood and we knew where each other lived.
And why was she doing that?
I think she may have had a sexual obsession with me for this reason or the other. And again, in this kind of world that you get into, those ideas about reality of like being a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old being attracted to a 11-year-old boy, those don't really compute anymore because your other reality is already so thrown out. So you don't have any, there's no guardrails anymore. And I mean, these things went to the point beyond just, you know, I would call that relatively innocent to some of the other things that were happening to me. I mean, before I could account for what was happening to me, I was meeting up with men from Craigslist at the time to engage in sexual activities.
How old were you?
Around then, I was 14, 15, and 16.
Yeah, Linda, it's so tragic, but it's not uncommon. And he expressed it so well in saying that there's no guardrails. Once you get into that world, like there's no standards, anything goes. Age doesn't matter. And it was Craigslist where I started, you know, hooking up with guys when I was, again, that age, you know, 14 years old, and some of them much older. And at that time, I didn't have the category in my mind that, like, this is abuse. But my heart was deceived and my heart was craving this connection. And so this isn't abnormal or uncommon. It should be abnormal and uncommon, but it doesn't matter what the social media site is or where, like, you find a place to find some depravity. And when your heart is deceived in this way, you crave that connection with people and you crave affirmation. And There's adult predators everywhere on all these sites.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, just that whole, the hookup culture, you know, and just, you know, talking to, once again, my daughter's peers, you know, what was normal in their peer groups, you know, really just sometimes even making challenges about, you know, how many people you hook up within a certain time, a given time. And, you know, I doubt there were really any guardrails there either. You know, they were just after a goal. So, you know, it's, the mindset, you know, regarding, well, just going back to, yes, those guardrails, you know, are gone, and just to see what comes out of that is just really, really heartbreaking and discouraging.
Absolutely.
How did you get to that point?
There was a constant necessity fomented by this ideology, I think, in me for pushing the envelope in a way that also, and I don't enjoy this word, but I guess validated me in terms of like what I was and like how I was going to be some woman that a man was attracted to. And again, just like never enough risk, never enough thrill-seeking behavior, never enough, you know, trying to distance myself into the most, you know, extreme thing. So if that meant engaging in sexual relations at that age with a man who was 50 years old, then that's what I did. And no moral teaching or no amount of a true, I think, deeper lack of desire and fear out of doing these things and knowing that I was being groomed would keep me away from it, because I was too enthralled by this whole spirit of evil, I think.
When we speak about evil, what exactly are we talking about?
I think in our faith we call it Satan, but I think I think there's a lot of different things you can call it. I mean, I think, you know, that he's a big part of it on the spiritual realm, but I think evil in general in our world today looks a lot like maybe more generally what you would call chaos. There's no rule or no social expectation or no moral that is not somehow oppressing someone from getting what they want. And if some of these people have their way, I think eventually they will get rid of everything that does not immediately satisfy some base whim on the part of an individual, no matter how bad that is for society, no matter how bad that is for everyone involved. And I think that once you have a lack of that, you have just some kind of Babylonian abomination of what used to be America and our future.
Yeah, there's so much that can be said culturally about that, just the chaos and how anything that would stop someone from acting on a whim is considered oppressive. That sums up so much of where we are right now in our culture and what is helping lead kids to these just horrible, destructive places.
Yeah, absolutely. I think of it, what comes to mind too is, and I'm not with the details here, but Alfred Kinsey, you know, his work, which goes back quite a ways, right? And so this isn't something new, you know, to really, you know, once again, remove these guardrails and just really have, go after whatever desire you have. And, you know, as he describes the chaos with that.
Yes, I think one of the things kids are craving and need so bad is stability, and everything is shifting in their life and they need stability, and that stability can be their faith in Christ. And we have a truth and a God that never changes, and kids are desperate for that type of stability.
And how did you move forward with your transition? How did you proceed knowing that your mom and dad and your family felt the way that they did about it?
I proceeded in like fear and trepidation sort of, you know, my peers around my, you know, my age group, so to speak. I would definitely, like at school and things like that, I would, you know, slowly kind of like have them start calling me by the name I wanted them to. You know, these kind of like social transition steps that mainly extended to like my peers, and also on the internet, right? I went by this name. I used, you know, female ways to address me, and wanted people to do the same, and kind of fantasized about this very strange world of being an adult and being able to do all these things that I wanted. I wanted to say here that like my parents around these times. So my mom is a nurse, my dad's a firefighter, paramedic, and, you know, they both have some proximity to the medical field in some way. You know, they're not doctors, but they, my mom in particular has a very deep, like, love for medicine and understanding it and the science behind it and cares about, like, honesty and truth behind it, right? So while, you know, these things were happening, you know, my mom wasn't just out here saying, well, no, I'm not doing any of this, right? She just wanted the studies of what was going to be the truth, right? Of what is, you know, what is going to be, what is going to be the most beneficial for my child? And if it is transition, then so be it to some extent. You know what I mean? If there's studies and evidence and whatever, right? But when she went to these doctors and to these therapists and to all these people that we're supposed to trust, just, you know, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or a Libertarian or this or that, you're supposed to be able to walk into the doctor's office and know that they're going to neutrally kind of like tell you the truth. And instead what happened was when my mom asked for evidence or presented conflicting evidence to what they were saying, which was just affirm and transition, she was treated with like contempt and told that her son was going to die and that I was, you know, that they, my parents were killing me and denying me and I was never going to have a future. I mean,
this makes me angry, Linda, and I know it does you too, and you have to navigate this with parents on how the medical community has been so swayed and is so manipulative that if you don't go along with this, your child's going to die. And that is absolutely abhorrent, and it's anti-science, and it's actually anti the truth.
Oh, right, absolutely. Well, and the point he makes here too about the, you know, his parents being in proximity to the medical community, that would be Tom and I, and Tom worked, you know, he's worked 35 years now in healthcare. So we've always had connections with medical people. And one thing that I found here is there's definitely not a consensus. So, you know, when he's speaking of the medical people, it would be the experts in this area of gender medicine. And when you're in contact with them, it's a way different approach than a large part of medicine. I think that what the problem we have is it's very difficult for people in the medical community to speak up. I do know of people in the medical community here that have taken that step to do so, and they can't do it without consequences. Some are facing some pretty serious consequences right now for just questioning. So there's a lot of fear in the medical community too, but I think it needs to be understood that there's not a consensus. I remember early on just even hearing about kind of the strangeness of the people in these departments. So, especially here in our community, it's very specialized. So, you know, some of the medical people might not even be in contact with these the issues that you know patients are coming in with. Now that it's becoming more and more widespread, it's pretty hard not to. But I think we're going to see more and more pushback in the medical community as more people are facing the decision of do I affirm this and continue to promote this, or do I take a stand?
Absolutely, and I hope and pray that more people in the medical community like stand up and. Know that we need a lot more whistleblowers. We know that a lot of this medicalization has been happening kind of secretly. I've said this before in the podcast, it's so ironic that so many people were claiming, oh, we're not like medicalizing children. But then as we've tried to pass bans on so-called gender-affirming care, they're like, oh, this is going to deny the necessary health care for hundreds of thousands or millions of children. It's like, I thought you weren't providing that care for children, but you obviously are if banning it would deny that type of care to hundreds of thousands or millions of children. And so there's a lot of deception within the medical world. There's a lot of denial. There's a lot of things happening secretively. And we need more people in the medical community to speak up and to refuse to participate and to sound the alarm bells on what's happening.
Absolutely.
That's the biggest thing that really hits me when I think about this is like these people that are just supposed to be neutral arbiters of truth were destroying my parents' minds with guilt and manipulation and, and somehow my parents, despite all that, weathered it and knew that the truth was on their side, which is one of the bravest things I've ever witnessed in my entire life.
I think it's very admirable, yeah. Admirable of them to stick up for you the way that they did. So you mentioned that your mom went to the doctor's appointments with you. When did those start? When did you start seeking consultations?
I think right after 13. So I think 13 and 14, my mental health began degrading fairly quickly around this time as well. I don't think coincidentally.
You think the transition was actively causing that?
Absolutely. I was living completely discordant with reality, and I think it begins to put you almost in a state of not textbook psychosis, but it's some kind of, you know, you're so distant from reality. You're living in these two worlds that. In this one world that wants to destroy the other one. and destroy yourself eventually and destroy my relationship with my family that I've always had. And so I just began really my behavior, my relationship with my brothers, my relationship with my parents just began collapsing. So she started bringing me in, not for just gender stuff, but for mental health stuff to figure out what was going on with me.
Yeah, and we see this so much, Linda, where the further someone gets along in transitioning, like their mental health declines, and the world that is affirming of that says, well, what they need is more affirmation and celebration, and this is because they're being oppressed. And it's like, no, it's he said it so well, it's because he's not living in reality, and this fake world put him at war with his real self. And mental health and behavior was declining rapidly, and we see that in so many kids who go down this road.
Oh, absolutely. I think it needs to be said, too, that there is that period of euphoria, you know, so you do see for a time that kids seem to be much happier, living in that affirmation and feeling like, you know, they finally have an answer to the problem. I remember, you know, when we were trying to find answers for our children's medical problems, when we finally got that answer, even though we didn't have a solution for it, we were just euphoric to finally get the answer. It felt so good, you know, something that we could pursue now that we weren't just in this place of questioning and uncertainty. So I can see why it is so alluring in that way to continue on, and why you do see the period where they do seem like they're doing well in it. But it's been now in these 10 years to watch, you know, around, you know, 5 to 7 years, sometimes earlier, sometimes later, but you start to see that downward movement where there's more distress, and, you know, they start to lose the ability to function in life, have a hard time holding down jobs, end up turning, you know, coming back home to their parents because they can't continue on. And sadly, suicides we're hearing more of suicides, and we've heard now a report that, you know, 19% more, they're more prevalent now, after transition. So, to me, just knowing that we've had this massive surge during the lockdown, my heart really does go out for all of these young people now that are kind of getting into that period of time where they're gonna start coming to facing reality, really, that this isn't the answer for their distress.
Absolutely. And hopefully there's not these stories that get out there that, you know, will prevent people from going so far to begin with. And like you said, initially, and I think this is right with any of our sin issues in our life, initially there's a euphoric feeling of this is doing something good for me. And then parents see that and they experience that, and they're trusting what their doctor says. And it's kind of one compromise after another. It's like, well, you just need to take this step. And it's like okay, well, that seemed to give them some peace for right now. But then there's no longer peace. It's like, well, now we have to take this step. And it's this progression that leads them into a deeper and darker hole. And the parents think that they're doing the right thing because that's what the medical professionals and the psychiatrists are saying, you know, needs to be done. And they're being manipulated into it and told that if you don't go along with this, then you're going to cause your child's death.
Oh, absolutely. I had a mom reach out to me a couple years ago. She had been totally affirming. They did medicalize their autistic son, and really felt, you know, that they were getting good care for her son. When we met, she said, you know, if I had met you earlier, I would have been angry with you at the things that you're saying, but now mm-hmm. I see it. And it's so tragic. Her son is not doing well now. So my heart does go out for the parents too that are affirming. And I've met with plenty of them as well. You know, they have watched a child really suffer, and, you know, to have that moment of relief, you know, for a parent too, we don't want to watch our children suffer. So I can understand for them too why, you know, they would think that, oh, maybe this is the answer.
Absolutely. And just like with anything, there's a spectrum of people, and there are people in our culture right now, there are parents where the parents are pushing this on their kids, and it's kind of a trendy, cool thing. And so to me, that is absolutely abusive, and the parents will be held accountable by God someday. But we have to have just compassion, and that's why we have to understand that every situation is different, whereas there are parents, even though they're misguided, generally think that they're doing the right thing and they're following the advice of so-called medical professionals, and they're seeing that, like, temporarily, oh, this seems to be helping, and so they keep going down that road of helping their child transition and providing the medical care. And it feels like for so many parents, it's a no-win situation, and it feels like there's no outcome that is good. And if they don't go along with it, then they're accused of, you know, contributing to their child's possible death. They're accused of being abusive, and it seems like there's no winning in this. And ultimately, we know that the Lord can win, that the Lord can redeem. But hopefully, as we know more and as we hear more of these stories, parents will give more resistance much earlier on.
Yes, I'm glad that, you know, you pointed that out too. I think it's good to hear the stories from the parents as well, because you're right, there are some that are encouraging this, and they've been calling it transhousing by proxy right now. And I've been in contact with grandparents who have their own children now, are raising their grandchildren, and saying that, you know, you need to affirm our child as whatever it might be, non-binary or the opposite sex. And if you don't, you're not going to get to see your grandchildren. So, you know, situations like that, it's unimaginable. I mean, these kids are toddlers. So, you really do have to wonder what's happening there.
Yes.
So was it just like a pediatric psychologist or?
If I'm being honest with you, I don't remember the initial title of the gentleman we spoke to in Stockton. I know he wasn't a psychiatrist initially, but he was some sort of therapist with me.
Okay. What would he say to you during these appointments?
I was just trying to kind of recount these details, but many of his things were, you know, and looking back, I think he was actually probably a good guy, right? And but it seemed we kind of tiptoed around the gender subject in a way that was, if I had to speculate, I think that he was probably forbidden from maybe looking at some of these things that were like, maybe we shouldn't do this by a Kaiser, right? He's a Kaiser, you know. I know in my experience, you know, my little experience in like the medical world, there are certain algorithms for, you know, every different kind of medical profession. If you see this, follow this chain down and do this, right? You can't freelance most of the time, right? Unless you're a really good surgeon or something, probably. But you can't just freelance. So there's probably somewhere that says, hey, if you see X gender dysphoria, their policy is to do this and this. At the same time, you know, he was trying to tell my parents that Kaiser was just, I think, then opening up, you know, gender clinics, or they were maybe not just opening up, but they were kind of starting to expand their, you know, gender clinic services, I think, out in Oakland and I think maybe Kaiser Vallejo. I don't remember the exact locations, but he was trying to get me referred to those, you know, with me trying to, I think, stay away from the topic for some reason. But also, I think, importantly, like, affirming me as who I am, right? Affirming me as who I wasn't, you know?
So but, he would speak to you in the with your preferred name, pronouns, and such?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yep. Was there anything that they'd ever told you that they never told to your mom or your dad? Were there ever, like, appointments that they would have where, like, they weren't in the room?
Yeah, for I had many of my appointments with him without them in the room. I think if I remember correctly, the majority of time I went there, my parents weren't in the room. It would be like, hey, do you want to try talking to your parents at the end of the session? we'll bring them in for 10 minutes or so, you know? And he would try to kind of like melt the ice that had started arising between me and my parents. You know, my parents were terrified about me. They had these, you know, they had these people telling them these things that were about to happen to me supposedly. And I was also, you know, making, you know, I was at this time making suicidal gestures. I was hurting myself. I was, you know, I was doing all kinds of things that were just not really my character when I was younger. You know, I wasn't saying I was a perfect kid, but I mean, this was almost night and day between like my kind of like, I don't want to say introverted, but quieter, pretty reserved self to these just aberrant behavior all of a sudden. So I think to this therapist's credit, he was trying to include them at least in the mental health thing specifically, you know, to try to figure out what was going on with me and help me.
It's kind of a unique detail, actually.
Yeah.
So how long did these,
that makes my heart break for these parents. And, you know, they're taking him to a psychiatrist because, I mean, they're desperate for help. And so they're turning to people who should be able to help. And, you know, as he said, he's given the psychiatrist kind of the benefit of the doubt now that he thought that if this guy truly is trying to help him, that there's this wave coming at him from these online sources that have influenced him so deeply. And it seems like it's an impossible position for these parents to be in.
Oh, right. And when I listen to him, I think that his parents must have done their homework too. I wonder if they didn't, you know, do some research to find out if they could find a non-affirming counselor. You know, that's one thing that we end up trying to do around here too. And it's very difficult to do that. You know, we do have some names of certain ones that we know are going to be looking at root issues and not go right to affirmation, but it is, like he said, it's protocol. So it's a fearful thing for some of these practitioners to step outside of that, knowing that they're supposed to be giving them the resources and they're supposed to be affirming right away. So it puts so many people in a very difficult position. And here is a place where I think I really encourage parents to reach out to support groups and be surrounded by parents that have gone through this that can kind of help them navigate that, because it's a very, very difficult
from
time.
From Christian non-affirming support groups.
Yes, exactly.
That's
exactly.
Because there's yes. plenty out there that are pushing this. And so it's just, you have to be so discerning on which voices are you listening to. And it's so hard when you don't know who you can trust.
Yeah, and I know a really good one too, just saying.
Yes. Yeah, we have you know, our parent support group with Calibrate, and then you lead one locally there in Minnesota that I know impacts many great parents. So find some resources, take some steps to connect with other godly Christ-centered parents who are walking through this.
Do these consultations go on for? Until you actually went into any of the medical parts of transition?
So I think I talked with this gentleman for about a year specifically. Things with my like kind of outward mental health signs, I don't want to say they improved, but they were at a less emergent spot, I think, in my parents' eyes. And as things went on, you know, my parents kind of tried to keep me away from thinking about going back to a doctor and trying to like push me away from it. But later on in high school, you know, I went to another, you know, series of kind of like doctor's appointments that were about another mental health issue I was suffering from. And eventually, you know, in an unrelated way, they gave me stimulants, they gave me Adderall. But they started kind of pressuring my parents there too. But in terms of actual gender interventions, my parents were very, were pretty staunch about keeping me away from these clinics, because I think they knew exactly what was going on in these clinics, and they saw them as slaughterhouses, I think, you know, to be, again, not to be melodramatic, but I think that's just exactly how my parents saw them, that once they let me get in those doors, there would be some pretty big issues.
Slaughterhouses, that's a pretty pointed way of describing these gender clinics, and I absolutely agree.
Yeah, it's difficult. What comes to mind is, being on the phone with a mom when she was in the parking lot. You know, her young daughter had come of age and was able to have the double mastectomy. And just crying and praying with her, and having not being able to do anything. It's hard to just imagine, that there are people in the medical community that are willing to do this. It just really blows my mind.
So after high school, especially as you went into your early adulthood, how did things change?
After high school, I had several pretty big mental health crises in high school. I began developing a pretty burgeoning substance abuse issue with marijuana, but alcohol in particular was skewing my behavior quite a bit. I was put on various different kinds of medications to alleviate some of these things that were going on. But I was just looking forward to running away. I was literally, the day I turned 18, I wanted to fly to Texas at that time. I was dating someone there at the time. And I was also linked up with some activist groups on the left there at the time, on the radical left there at the time. And at that time, my plan was to I'm going to go on estrogen in my case, and I'm going to start pursuing these interventions, right? All throughout high school, I definitely, even though my appearance wasn't changing very much with my peers, so many people were in this ideology back then and okay with it, right? That I could, at high school, my school was pretty small too. I could, in my peer groups, live in this kind of bubble where I was living as a girl, right? And so I was completely ready to just continue this in a way where I was okay, now I can get the medical interventions. Now I can look different than how I want to, or I can look how I want to, right? So I was just gleeful about running away. And that runaway didn't last very long, ultimately.
How'd it go?
I ended up hospitalized. And I was kind of returned to sender to my parents' house back in Lodi again. I had a series of these moments in my life, right? People in 12-step programs call it the geographical solution, where they think that, your problems, if you just keep moving all over the place, it's going to get better, right? I moved to San Diego. I moved to Colorado. I moved all over as an adult, right? Pursuing more different periods of medical intervention, pursuing my substance problem. And, every time I would get to these places, I was still there, unfortunately. So the solution never worked, because everywhere I turned, there was me everywhere I went. So, and eventually, these geographical solutions to my identity crisis and these things that I was going through just eventually shattered.
I think the word that keeps coming to my mind is escape. I talk about that so much with transgenderism, is that escaping something, and he was trying to escape this stress he felt, but then you use drugs to try to escape reality. You keep changing locations. If I'm around the right people, the right things, I can escape. And ultimately, the problem is ourselves, our own sinful heart, and we can't ever escape that. And at the end of the day, we're still there, and we can't escape who we are and who God made us to be. And we need that person to find redemption and wholeness and hope in Christ, instead of trying to run from that person and tried to escape.
At what point did you actually start taking any interventions? What did the course of that look like? What did you take?
So when I became an adult, I think my first interventions, I moved so many places, so I went through different medical systems and doctors, but And with my kind of substance abuse issue, I stopped taking care of myself, even in this realm of like, you know, again, I wouldn't really call it taking care of myself, but with doing gender medicine, I would stop doing it on and off. But I think one of my first ones was Planned Parenthood, because I could just basically walk in there, sign something, and they'd send me home with, you know, a prescription for what I wanted, right? So I went on that for a few months, and then, like I was saying, there were periods of months where I stopped being able to get the medication. I stopped, I got very, you know, brushing my teeth was not on the top of my list some days with how I was taking care of myself. So going and getting medicine from a doctor was, but when I turned, I think 21 or 22 years old was my most consistent period of, I would nonstop, hormonal use. You know, and up to this point I did start like cross dressing more and start trying to present female more, but that period from, I believe, 21 years old until the end of my transition was sort of my nonstop go at it. But before that, in those years, I had, you know, very inconsistent treatment that was, I think, mind shattering. I mean, I think literally I was altering my mind in ways where none of these doctors cared if I had been on the medicine before, if I had a prescription before, or what was going on with me, right? I mean, I'm literally dumping, you know, female hormones into myself, and I'm just doing this all the time with hormones, with medicine. I had psychiatric medicines on board. I was using various, you know, illegal and legal substances concurrently with this, and no one bothered to ask, which I think is pretty telling about the state of our medical system.
How did it affect you medically, both mentally and physiologically? Especially being on and off of it.
Yeah, I think my mood and my capacity to handle some of the other mental problems I was struggling through was like diminished a hundredfold by my hormonal problems, you know. But again, none of these doctors that I was coming to with these other issues, right, or that my parents were bringing me to, being like, you know, hey, this is really bad, or any, you know, recovery, you know, from substance abuse places, never bothered to ask, hey, do you think these hormones maybe aren't helping? The only people with any sense enough to ask were my mom and dad.
And I think this is so common, Linda, and it's so tragic. Like, every doctor, clinic should be trying to understand what's going on, but they keep pushing these medications and these, you know, whether it's puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and not pausing to say, you've been on these so many times and it was leading you to a worse place. This isn't healthy and this isn't good. But instead, just here's another prescription. Just do more of it.
Yeah. Planned Parenthood, you know, being so big in this, and, you know, the other stories I hear are, you know, finding places where you can mail order the hormones as well. So, and there'll even be groups within your community that will help you set up, even help minors set up PO boxes to have these prescriptions delivered to. So to get access to these wrong sex hormones is just very, very easy.
Yes, and it's just being done. Obviously, it shouldn't be done at all, but so haphazardly where, you know, he was struggling so badly and none of these doctors' clinics were even asking any questions, just handing them out.
Yeah, I've heard recently, I'm trying to remember if it was Forrest, a detransitioner, talk about, you know, even homeless people having surgeries and then sent back out on the street, you know, and you need special aftercare with these surgeries, the follow-ups. And so just the level of malpractice in some of these cases is just I hope there are some consequences, you know, to some of these actions.
Yes.
You know, saying like, this is changing you. This medicine is making you a different person, and it's affecting your ability to stabilize in any, you know, substantive way.
So while you were going through this process, going through the medical stages of it, what were some of the negative effects, or maybe even positive effects, of these drugs that you were on?
Initially, I began to develop definitely a difference in my skin texture. Smoother doesn't quite describe it because my skin was still my skin, especially on places like my hands. But definitely, like, my veins became less noticeable and my pores became kind of smaller, especially on my face. I also began very slowly, but some kind of, like, breast development. My fat redistributed to different places on my body. At the time, some of these effects were positive to me, right? But they were very, very gradual. You know, a big difference in my story and a lot of other people's, right, is that I was through puberty and through, you know, much of puberty once I, you know, maybe all of it almost, once I kind of began hormones in earnest. So a lot of these changes that can be done are somewhat gradual with hormones. On the negative side, I can't speak to, you know, 100% specifics, but I mean, my psychiatric, or my psychological capability to maintain my composure, maintain my emotions, tanked. I mean, like a few months after starting to take these, every kind of run that I would, and especially in my last kind of run, so to speak, where I was taking very high dosages of you know, estrogen and sometimes doubling my dosage because I thought it would somehow improve the feminizing effects of it. I mean, it was, you know, I think psychologically, you know, people might underestimate the effects of hormones, right? Because I could definitely feel, you know, just emotional turmoil when these things were fluctuating. I mean, just full on, like, just a crisis in my head all the time, you know, not only of, you know, the hormones doing it, but also, like, my obsession with the hormones as this, like, ritual that was somehow going to solve these problems about my insecurity. You know, that was one of the biggest parts of it, is this obsession with medicalization that will somehow solve every insecurity you've ever had. You know, there's very few other medical fields that I know of, except maybe weight loss, where a doctor will walk up to you and give you a pill or an injection or this and say, this will fix all of your problems that you have when you look in the mirror with yourself. You know, I mean, it is a ritual, I think, to try to alleviate problems that couldn't possibly be alleviated by this. And the hormones themselves, you know, have also left me with, like the deformity of my chest. And the thing that bothers me, I think, a lot about this treatment is that, like, I don't even 100% know what I've been left with completely, because there's studies now that are coming out that, you know, and that are being done that are just now looking at the long-term effects of these hormones later on in life. I mean, we're talking things like, you know, I've seen a study, and I'm not saying how credible or not credible it is, but I've seen a study talking about possible links to multiple sclerosis. You know, I've seen things talking about life expectancy, more likely to get certain types of cancers. I mean, I think one of the more horrible things about these medical interventions is that, you know, we're doing this, giving people no alternatives for treatment of what they call gender dysphoria, and we don't even know what these things do on a long-term basis. We really can't say. I don't think that anyone can say confidently there are no complications to these, because we don't have enough data to say so. And I think that's a crime that will eventually be of historic note.
Yeah, Linda, it's so tragic, and it's so true that this is being given as the answer to all of your problems. And it's just ludicrous to think that any medication is going to solve the discomfort, the dysphoria, the depression, the image issues, the insecurities. And yet, here, take this pill. And it's having devastating consequences. And I think that now the studies are showing a lot of those devastating consequences. And the more we know, the worse it looks. But so much of our world is completely ignoring that and will not acknowledge the devastating consequences that the medicalization has in the long term.
Yes. Oh, that's, yeah, the list goes on and on and on. I kept compiling lists, and they just keep growing of the different things. And we've seen early on, you know, heard from parents that have shared different complaints that their kids have health issues that they were trying to figure out, you know, that were seemed to clearly be coming from taking wrong sex hormones, which totally makes sense. You know, we know how important it is to keep these things in balance. So, I'm glad that we're at least getting some coverage of that now, and I think it is making a difference in court cases. I just read of one this morning. I think it was in Australia, but it was a judge who was very well equipped to just take down some of the arguments with the information that's out there. So that was encouraging to me. The other thing that he mentioned here, you know, he mentioned earlier, I like the word when he said that he, you know, became absorbed. And here he says, you know, the obsession. And, you know, hearing of that too, once again, makes me think of that so many of these kids have ADHD, OCD, and autism. So it's just, it's so fitting that, you know, they would become very obsessed with these answers and going down this pathway.
Absolutely. And sometimes we become obsessed with all kinds of things that we think will be a solution to our problem. But most of the time, those solutions don't have just such tragic, horrible, devastating consequences. Sometimes they do, but just this is such a bizarre answer to someone's problems that it's ludicrous that it's being peddled on our kids and our adults.
Right. And I guess, you know, I keep bringing this up about the comorbidities. It's because I'm seeing the vulnerability. We're talking about very vulnerable kids. And, you know, that was the thing that really struck us early on, that this is a group of very vulnerable kids. Not that there aren't kids that, that don't have these vulnerabilities. Yeah, it's just, I mean, we've said this before, puberty itself can be enough of a vulnerability, but we do clearly see some of many of these comorbidities showing up.
Is there anything that you personally have been left with?
I mean, for me, mostly, you know, I was told when I went to the doctor very early on in my detransition that, you know, I would be infertile, and they were pretty sure of that. Obviously, that's borne out not to be true. And mainly just the fact that now with the breasts that I've developed, or the resemblance of breasts, I guess you could say, my insurance does not cover removing them. They covered me getting them, but they didn't cover me removing them, which I think is sort of interesting to note. And, you know, every day I kind of like, I wear a compression fabric essentially to remove a binder. Yeah. To remove the appearance of those. And it's detrimental on me physically.
You know, there's so much that could be said there, but, we see people have so many medical side effects from this, and then it's not covered by their insurance, or some of the doctors then won't even treat that or help with that, especially, you know, with the bottom surgeries. Obviously, that does completely sterilize people, especially if you're a male and you're having your genitals removed, then you're completely sterilized. And people have urinary problems, you know, bladder issues, and it's devastating. And then there's such little help available for them in that.
Right. And I heard a study recently where they said 75% of detransitioners don't go back to their doctors. They've lost so much trust. You know, so it's there's just going to be a huge, huge need as these concerns continue to rise.
Which is what females who transition into male identities and lifestyles use to hide their breasts. And you're now using this device as a man.
Exactly. Yeah, it's it is kind of an interesting parallel. I've thought about that a lot of the, I mean, I think you and I have kind of discussed it, like these kind of parallels between the problems that it's starting to cause me and the problems that maybe it caused you and caused other young women and women before. I mean, it's a very negative impact on my life. And I think that, again, it's interesting that we have a medical system that will gladly deform you, but will not as happily or eagerly go to fix you, because I think to some extent they realize that that would be an admission of guilt.
Why do you think that there's such a motivation to promote and do these procedures in the first place? And why do people like us get ignored?
These institutions, I think, have been infiltrated by this ideology that we've kind of talked about, this evil, this ideology that's accompanied this evil, that if you question the, you know, veracity of their claims, if you question the truthfulness of their claims, the goodwill towards their patients that they may or may not have, that you are somehow bigoted or evil or angry or just lying or deceiving. And I think that I would go so far as to say that we are contradictions to their theses about us, right? Because they see, to be able to get these experimental treatments by, they have to kind of simultaneously claim that if you do them and you regret them, then they're not that harmful, right? And for some of us, I think that that can be like more true than others. I think that some of us suffer from more complications than others. But for the most part, I saw no benefit, real benefit from it in my life. I saw no positive outcome. My mental health deteriorated. Everything that you could measure deteriorated once I was administered these things. Catastrophically. I know a lot of people like that. So if you have people like us where that's the case and some of these things are more difficult to reverse or to treat after, then it contradicts their whole worldview. And I think that makes them very upset for us to be contradicting their worldview.
Were you just on estrogen, or were you on, did you undertake any other?
I was on they prescribed me estrogen, and spironolactone was the usual other one that I was on, and they prescribed that, to my understanding, as a testosterone blocker. So it's a diuretic, I think, but the off-label use is a testosterone blocker.
How did your life change as you were going through the later parts of your transition?
My life at that point, despite this very beautiful life that I had in many ways and these beautiful things that I had in many ways up until, you know, my exposure to these things, and in some parts even after I was exposed to these things. I mean, I had a beautiful, healthy family. I had some very good friends who were good influences on me. I had everything going for me. And in this later part that you're talking about, I slouched towards a Luciferian destruction of my life. I slouched towards every lowest end that I've ever been at kind of took place in that period. And every reservation I had of something, oh, I would never do this or I would never do that, they all fell through eventually. You know, especially with substance abuse coupled with this, you know, crisis of conscience and not being in touch with who I am as a man at that time turned me into just someone a very pitiful individual, I would say.
When I've heard other detransitioners describe, some of them that, you know, we know personally, that their mental health had declined to where they were just a shell of a person, like can't function. And yet we still keep doing this, and there's no that these people aren't experiencing positive outcomes from it. And yet the world keeps denying the damage that's being done.
Yeah, I couldn't help thinking of James 1:14, you know, just that, but each person is tempted when he's lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it's conceived, gives birth to sin. You know, he just talks about that path, you know, as he continued to move forward on that path. And, it's really sad that, they, after, you know, they they get to this place where he said, you know, he just continued to get worse. They'll be piling on more medication to treat other problems that they're having. Mm-hmm. You know, that might be the time that they're finally getting their diagnoses mm-hmm. for other, you know, issues that they, you know, things that they were dealing with. So, it's just such a backwards way of treating. And, yeah, it's really tragic to hear this, and we hear it again and again and again. I'm glad when we can avoid it, but it's we see it a lot.
We're starting to get into a very spiritual aspect of this, so I have to ask, like, during this time, where were you at in your religious journey?
So throughout a lot of this, I was involved with some radical left-wing people, and I can tell you that throughout a large portion of my life in this period, that my God was unironically communism. And that was not an exaggeration to say that. I would say that in recovery meetings. I would say that, you know, this idea of this communist party was going to be my God. And that, of course, annihilates any relationship that you can have to something real, I think. And later on, though, after that, and during kind of the end period of that, I started kind of searching out for a real kind of higher power in my life. And eventually I found that in, you know, at first I found it in, I'd be really going through some tough times. And I remember one time I was walking out of a motel that I was staying in because I, you know, didn't want to stay anywhere else because I didn't want to be near my parents or be near anyone, because I wanted to use substances. And I walked by this like big Virgin Mary mural. And I was like, you know, I'd walk by that sometimes and I would just be like, you know, if you're listening or your son is listening, like, could you help me out? You know, just not really taking it seriously, but just kind of willing to do anything at that point. And so at first that took me towards Catholicism, and then because I was not ready to engage fully with the social teachings of the Catholic Church because I was identifying as a woman, and living a, you know, transiently homosexual lifestyle and a drug addict lifestyle, I went to the Episcopal Church, eventually was baptized in the Episcopal Church, and then when I detransitioned, I am now currently in catechism for the Catholic Church.
Right on.
Yeah.
Were you religious before in your earlier life?
When I was a kid, I went to a Seventh-day Adventist school, and I'd say when I was young, you know, third grade and stuff like that, I kind of took it at face value, but I wouldn't say I ever engaged with it on a really deep level at that time. And between that kind of like youthful sort of like kind of like going along kind of attitude and being a diehard, you know, communist and atheistic, I was sort of indifferent, right? I really liked thinking about like the mysteries of the universe and everything, but I did it on a very skeptical sort of level, I would say. You know, I was an agnostic if I had to, you know, if I had to guess how I was in high school, I guess I'd call myself an agnostic, but I felt these draws a lot towards God in my life because I would just look at things like, I really love the ocean. And when I look at the ocean, I can find no great cosmic explanation for like our oceans off our coast here besides something that would be called God, even at that time. But, you know, yeah, I felt continuous draws to it for sure.
Linda, you know, he brought up communism there, and all these issues, they are spiritual issues. Obviously, you know, we believe, like you'd mentioned from James 1:14, that we're, you know, enticed by the evil that's in our hearts. And so many of these issues comes down to, like, what is our source of truth? And we can live in a Christianity where we know the true, real God, and He is our source of truth. He is our source of understanding of who we are and who He made us to be, and gives us this order in a world that seems so chaotic. Like, He created order and he created systems, and he created things with intentionality. And when we deviate from that, we become our own gods, and we turn to other gods to try to get the answers to things. And we see that spirituality so much within transgenderism.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, that's one thing I've appreciated Carl Truman for, you know, the rise and triumph of the modern self, you know, that there's that need for something outside of ourselves. And I think there has been so much about self-esteem and self-focus and all of the self. And so there's just such a strong desire to take hold of something outside of that. You know, they're obviously in that place of self, they're in so much distress and pain. And so you can see why it can be a tempting thing. And it's the most prevalent thing in our culture right now, too, coming from all different directions. So it definitely is a very popular thing for trans-identified young people to be also identifying as communism. They do carry the whole, encompass the whole belief system.
Absolutely. And there's so many things that could go into that, specifically with communism, but, you know, kind of like this lack of taking responsibility for yourself. I don't know what all those different areas are, but, you know, making yourself your own God, there could be so many different spiritual parallels there. You know, he was agnostic and, said he had a draw towards God for so many years. And it's like that's true. I think true of all of us in some ways, because, you know, we have the law of God written on our hearts and we want to understand what is true, but it's our sinful hearts that just hardens ourselves and pushes out the truth and suppresses the truth.
Yes. And what a beautiful, I mean, just hearing this redemption story unfolding, you know, really to hear how far, you know, he said he had hit bottom or, you know, come to the end of himself there, and to see that there's always hope. So it's
absolutely
just, it's a beautiful telling.
What was it that eventually led to the end of your transition?
So I was a few months before my detransition, I was at like this incomprehensibly horrible end of the road of my life. I was very deeply tied into substance abuse. I was hurting my family. I was hurting everyone I knew. I was probably more or less literally killing myself slowly. Every day was just horrendous. A lot of it was of my own doing. And a lot of it had to do with this anger and rage over, you know, what I looked like at, like, my, you know, my male kind of phenotypes and my, you know, secondary sex characteristics. And
I think that's an interesting statement, kind of this rage over his male characteristics. And I see that in a lot of people who have transitioned, where they're desperate to erase any evidence of who they're supposed to be, but some things can never be changed. And the hormones might change some things temporarily, but there are so many markers of who they're supposed to be physically, with their memories, with their family, and that can just never be changed or undone.
It's not a surprise that there's such a demand for affirmation, right? You know, because they themselves know it's not true. And so they so much need that, you know, to be heard constantly.
Mm-hmm.
But I got through a lot of the, I got through eventually, by the grace of God, a lot of the substance abuse side of things. So my life, you know, after that period, it improved to a really high level. I mean, I was doing really well. I met a girl I really like, or a woman I really like, and I had a great life, but I had this just like shadow just following me around of this gender, you know, ideology madness still, that was slowly, even as I was really approaching kind of the zenith of my life so far, was slowly kind of towing me back towards that same, that old life, right? It was like this vestige of it that was just like clawing on, wanting to like bring me back into this really bad world. It was literally pushing me back into, you know, desiring substances to try to like ease this, this mental pain of like, you know, feeling like I look too this way or I look too that way or this is too big, my jaw is wrong or anything like that. And one day I was, and it sounds sort of silly, I guess, but I was watching a video of a now departed Catholic priest named Mark Beard, and or Father Mark Beard. And he said, you know, and I was having these thoughts, right, of like, I really don't like this community, so to speak, that is surrounding gender ideology. A lot of it's predatory, a lot of it's hedonistic, a lot of it's evil.
Not to mention toxic.
Not to mention toxic. It's not like I had any very good friends that, you know, treated me very well among these people. But he said, like, you know, paraphrasing him, he had this one homily where he said, you're either walking towards him or you're walking away from him, you know? And that exact part, you know, you're either in or you're out. You know, you're either walking towards him or walking away from him. That idea that, like, the reason that things are not, even though I have everything I want now and I'm free from this awful disease that was destroying me, is because the core problem of this gender crisis in me is still here and I haven't extracted it yet. And I remember looking in the mirror, and this was shortly after, you know, my facial reconstruction consultation.
You're about to have surgery.
I was. I mean, it would have been, the surgery itself would have been a few years out, but I was about to also go into I forget the name of the operation, but shortening my Adam's apple, and that would have been in about, I think, a month or two from when this was. I forget the operation's name, actually, but I just looked in the mirror, and I thought to myself, like, maybe it would be okay to just be me. And the fact that I attributed being male to me for the first time in, you know, even just in my head for, you know, the first time in more than a decade was mind-boggling. And I think, you know, and so I started taking slow steps, you know. I started, like, telling my, you know, significant other. I kind of told my parents I was thinking about it. And then the day before I had a job interview, I stopped taking the medication. And then the day before I had a job interview, I went in and I cut my hair all the way down to shorter where it is now, which is even as a young man, I think we talked about this earlier, that's still a pretty short length for me. And I went to that job interview and I said, hi, my name's Luke. And that was it. You know, I've never looked back since those moments. And I,
wow, what a powerful moment where he just finally contemplated what would it be if I was just me, and he knew that that was male.
Beautiful. I know when I watched this the first time, I was just like, arms in the air, hallelujah! You know, yeah. And just to hear, I mean, this is what we parents pray for, and we've had the chance to experience some of these stories right now, too, and see lives changed. But just, oh, what a beautiful, and, you know, his telling, too, about, you know, the message that he got, you know, that took really that turn in his life, that repentant turn, you know, in his life. And, you know, there's so much theology, so the steps of man, you know, and so just beautiful to hear that he's walking this now. He's walking out the life of truth, and it's just beautiful.
Absolutely.
Could not be more grateful. And I don't think I've done anything wonderful to deserve these things in my life, but I can't emphasize how amazing they are to me.
Well, I think it's about so much more than deserve. I mean, you had the maturity to be able to reflect, to look at yourself and understand that all of this was outside of the bounds of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that takes a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think I had a lot of help from God and from my parents and my brothers and my significant other and my church. But I mean, the things
that makes a difference.
Yeah, the community for sure. And I mean, watching people, you know, like you and people like Dr. Peterson talk about detransition and stuff online, you know, just to try to understand what do I do now?
So you knew about me. You knew about publicly speaking detransitioners at this point in time before you detransitioned.
I knew about it very, very on a surface level. You know, my mom would try to kind of bring people like you and like that, and you know, some concerns about gender ideology up to me when I was still very deep in my journey, so to speak.
Well, tell her she's cool for that.
I will absolutely tell her that. She's a very cool lady. But yeah, so I mean, I was beginning to be plugged into a community, and you know, I had a good base community and family and everything. But a task of the magnitude of retrieving me from where I was, I mean, in a very deeply bad and just malignant place, I think only God could have done that for me. And I think he did.
I love to see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm glad that you're back.
Thank you.
Do you think that that's what it takes to ultimately fully heal from this? It takes God?
Absolutely. I think God, or whatever being that you might attribute something higher to than yourself or to another human being, is necessary, because the depths that you descend to are too dark to get through by yourself. They bring you to a place that you, as a human being, you know, as an imperfect person, are just incomprehensible. And the way to get out of them is incomprehensible, I think, just to, at least it was to me alone. I had no idea that getting out was even an option. And one day, you know, all it took was just me, like, taking the hand up, you know? And that was it. It was from that day onward. I mean, hasn't been perfect. It hasn't been, you know, all roses, but it's been easier than my life has ever been.
I think that's the Christian life right there, right? It's not perfect and it's not roses, but, you know, and there's hard, hard moments, but he says that his yoke is easy and his burden is light. And God does stuff in us and for us that we never could have done on our own. And so, you know, that should, for parents and friends and coworkers who are trying to navigate this with other people, it's like, we have a role to play, but ultimately it's God who brings them to a sense of reality. And it has to be God who does some work inside of them to, kind of bring them out of their spiritual stupor.
Yes, I think there's just so much for parents in that clip. You know, they're just, you know, this is a spiritual battle, you know, and he gives testimony to, you know, needing something above himself, you know, that supernatural intervention. And I think too, an encouragement for parents to stand in truth, because how beautiful that he had them to go back to. He didn't have to then try to undo all of that, you know, to not only, you know, come to that realization to himself, but now to backtrack with his parents too. So that part is just such an encouragement. I've heard recently a new kind of estrangement that's happening since there are so many detransitioners, that parents who have been very supportive and even, you know, really going to battle for their child's trans identity, have now been, in a sense, estranging themselves from their children who have detransitioned, mm-hmm. because they're, you know, it's like they felt like they've been let down. You know, I've given all to this. I fought for you. I went to battle, and now you're going to do this to me. You know, so it's really hard then for some of these parents too, to have to also make that big transition in their life.
Yes. And, you know, we want parents to hold the line. And obviously, Luke's parents were full of grace and love and maintained a relationship and had compassion towards him. But they fought for truth in his life. And, you know, what I see this all the time, whether it's a detransitioner or someone who's leaving homosexuality, the people in their life who are in supporting their sin, then aren't in a place to walk them through God's sanctification and discipleship. And that's what I want for parents, like you said, a home for them to go back to where they can be part of the solution in God rebuilding their life. And if they've been affirming this entire time, then they were part of the problem. They were part of the deception. And sometimes, you know, when the parents hold the line on truth, there's some estrangement and there's broken relationship, and we don't want that. We mourn that. But in the meantime, I want parents to grow in maturity so that they have the spiritual maturity so that when their child comes to their knees in repentance before God, their parents' home is a place where they can come home to be welcomed. They're like the prodigal son, and the parents are in a place to walk alongside and help their child undo what their heart had, you know, twisted. And they can't do that if they were in an affirming place.
How is your life now compared to then?
Incomparable. Today I, you know, I have wonderful friends like you and like other people that we know. And I, you know, look myself in the mirror every day. I don't hate myself. I have a great community and 12-step recovery programs. I have a great church. I have a relationship with my brothers, and particularly my little brother, that I never had before, that I never thought would be possible, and with my dad and with my mom. My relationship with my little brother being repaired is, maybe aside from the detransitioning itself and being free from substances, maybe the single greatest miracle I've ever experienced in my life. And I don't know how to thank God enough every day for that, because it was never going to happen. We were never, ever going to talk to each other in a normal, kind way ever again. And I can't thank him enough for doing that for me. So, and I just have a beautiful life today that's full of options, where before I had a life that had one trajectory, and it was probably death or jail or a mental institution. Or, you know, and also, you know, I had a, with my body, you know, my only trajectory was going to be further botching of my body. You know, I was never going to be able to be a male in a way where I wasn't going to mutilate myself. And I was going to have a very sad health outcome. And there's still some things that, like, I'm going to struggle with and that I do struggle with today. But today I don't have to worry about those things. And I don't ever have to, I'm promised a slightly brighter future than that at the very, very least.
It sounds like you have a lot of hope.
I do. I have more hope than I ever have. I think that's one of the single biggest maybe things that sometimes when I see people that maybe would disagree with people like you and I, that I really want to give to them, because it's very real. It's very tangible. The difference of hope in my life versus just despair every day that things were never going to improve and that things shouldn't improve, even. I'd go that far to say that I believe that, you know.
And I think that even people who are on the other side and may not align with us yet, they deserve to have that same hope and healing for themselves. So how would you extend that to them? How would you speak to maybe a young man who's experiencing the same things that you did and the same feelings that you had at the time?
I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways to come at it for different people, but the central thesis of it has to be that, you know, God or whatever this young man happens to believe in, you know, even if you just want to say the universe created you individually just as you are to be you, to be a young man, to be this and to be that. And there are all kinds of different young men and there are all kinds of different young women, you know. I'm certainly not the end all be all of masculinity. I have, you know, my older brother is much more masculine than I am in many ways. My younger brother too. But I'm still a man, and I'm very happy to be a man. And I'm grateful to God that He made me a man and gave me this individual role in life. And that life has these differences kind of prescribed to us in ways that are beautiful beyond our understanding and that are amazing in a way that we could never design ourselves. And these feelings of being young or out of place or out of tempo with where you should be or where you shouldn't be in life,
So that's so beautiful in understanding that God made me a man, and yet I'm different than every other man, and be able to hold those things in balance and rejoice in who God made us to be, and understanding that my manhood and me as a person is nothing like, is not exactly like any other man. And you as a woman, you have the freedom to embrace womanhood, embrace the role and the giftings God gave you by just virtue of being a woman. And yet you're unique and different in some ways than every other woman. And I think if we embrace that, it would solve so many of our issues in putting people in these boxes and making them insecure in their talents and abilities and their looks and so many areas that initially caused some of this distress.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I couldn't have said it better. He just did such a beautiful job.
Someone's commandment to you, who's another human being, to how you have to be and how you have to resolve this by hurting yourself in any way with gender ideology, with substance abuse, with, you know, talking bad about yourself, with doing things that you know you shouldn't, is never, ever the answer. I can tell you that I'm not that old, but I've done a lot of things in this same vein, and it hasn't just been transitioning. You know, like I've emphasized a few times, substance abuse has been a part of it too. It's never fixed the problem. And I've been at it for, you know, I went at it for more than 10 years, so I would know if it did. And I can promise you it doesn't. So I think that just knowing that, and that things get better than those kind of like awkward times and those kind of like difficult moments of, you know, self-doubt when you're young, there's a brighter future ahead, and it gets brighter if you just let it, you know, and if you work towards it in a way that's not destructive to yourself.
I think that young men of today have kind of a unique set of problems, especially compared to our fathers, our grandfathers, the men of the past. There's a bit of a, I would even say, a crisis of masculinity and identity amongst young men.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, again, kind of like I was saying in the beginning, was the type of ideas that young men are being exposed to about themselves and about women especially, and about their relationships with women and their relationships with themselves and the world, and how, you know, on one hand, men are all evil, and on the other hand, you know, women are all bad. And, you know, it's like society is communicating all these ideas at once, I think, maybe almost on purpose to be confusing, but they're bewildering. They were bewildering to me. I had no way to process these ideas as a young person. And I don't think there's really a lot of reasonable ways to process these ideas, because they're not reasonable ideas.
Yeah, Linda, our kids are being raised in such a confusing time where manhood is bad and girls are insecure, and we have to help our kids process those messages they're receiving. So, like, how can we help our kids understand who they are and their identity and process this world around them that's giving them so many negative messages about manhood and womanhood?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And try to pull them back, you know, from all, you know, the measure of those influences. We can't avoid them completely, but you know, being intentional about, you know, getting them in healthy spaces.
Absolutely. And, you know, developing relationships, we're listening and we're trying to help them understand what's going on in their own hearts, you know, because it's so confusing. They don't even know how to process that at times. And, you know, and sometimes we'll still end up with a child, like, all children are sinners and we can't fix everything about them. We need Jesus to do that, but we have a role to play, and we do it surrendered to the Lord, knowing that we need him to work inside our kids.
Absolutely. And to realize too that he's working in us. I mean, I think that's the beautiful thing too. I had the opportunity, I reached out to a new parent group and asked for just some conversations with moms of boys. And I had one from Connecticut, Georgia, Michigan, Virginia, Florida, Texas. And the thing that really struck me was the beautiful testimonies of the transformation in their lives through this trial. So we can miss out if our focus is just on, you know, the deliverance or the, you know, just kind of waiting for the victory. There's so much that can be done in our lives and in a way that God is working on us in this time too.
Absolutely. You're in our parents' ministry, and so you know that the focus isn't fixing your kids. It's applying the gospel to your own life and growing in ways through this journey that parents never imagined they needed to grow.
And hopefully when those kids come back, they'll see a changed mom and dad too in a positive way, right?
Absolutely.
They are ludicrous by their nature. And I think nowadays we're just seeing more and more of an increase of this emphasis on ego and on superficial desires coming above the betterment of our families and of our country and of the people that we love. And the betterment of ourselves, not for some self-seeking ends, but to be truly like men and women of God. That's not emphasized anymore. It's all about gratification. And there's nothing to aspire to anymore that's above, you know, another dollar, another virtuous social cause that I'm a part of, or another modification I can do to my body to fit in with my friends, or sexual gratification. We've stripped our society of higher aims than that. And I think that's made young men crazy in many cases.
So how do we amend that? How do we fix that for our future generations?
People, I'm reluctant to say that I have the answer to this. I think that alongside these very confusing social pressures, there's also the very confusing phenomenon that every, 24-year-old my age has every answer to all the world's problems. But I will say that I think one of the main things that I felt and that, my mom has talked to me a lot about is people need to take their families back, and they need to say, they need to be able to sit down with their families and say, this is what, is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. And if you want to talk about it, if you see something at, school or work or something that we need to talk about because it's totally wrong to you, then we can talk about it. We can talk about it frankly. We can talk about uncomfortable things. We can talk about comfortable things. We can talk about things we never heard of before to try to understand them through a family's lens. But I think that, we have to stop letting our children be raised by social media and by tablets and by media, which is full of people that are not always, that do not always have the best intentions for our children. We have, if I have one sure idea, I would say that would help. Absolutely. We have to stop letting our children be raised by ideologues that do not want what is best for them, even slightly.
So since you are the first male who I've interviewed on the subject, do you think there's unique experiences and struggles that males who transition and detransition experience as compared to women?
Absolutely. I think men transitioning in general, I think we can often sort of fall prey to more of the, very acting in very sexually inappropriate ways towards, females and other people in these communities go. I think that, even men in dresses or men identifying as women tend to be on a whole, not totally, but more predatory than, their female counterparts. And I think that we were being taught that acting that way is okay. I also think that there is a huge component of despair in male transitioners, because when you're talking about being a man, I think this applies to many men across all kinds of levels of, masculinity, if you want to say it that way, and all kinds of desires about life someday. When you are emasculating yourself for so long, it is impossible to me to think that is a productive spiritual road to go down. And I think it takes people like me and people who are still on that road to very dark mental places. And the shame of abandoning ourselves as men is is sometimes very insurmountable, and the embarrassment of coming back to being men after living this very kind of, I think it's fair to say, sort of shameful, sad life for a long time, you know, sometimes doing really horrendous, grotesque things, is horrible. And I think it is unique to men in some ways, and it's universal between all of us in other ways.
I think that in general, there's a lot less forgiveness for men for pretty much anything. It's a lot harder to come back socially as somebody who was emasculated for years as compared to a woman who was more butch or more masculine.
Yeah, Linda, I loved what he said about, you know, taking our families back and making sure that we're the main influence in our family's lives. There's a lot that could be said there. I know there's been so many studies done and articles about how kids are detaching from their families so much younger, to where they're still living in their parents' house, but they are under the authority of people online and social media. They've emotionally detached and are no longer being influenced by their families as their main source of influence at the age of, you know, 13, 14, 15. And so that is a major red flag. And like, we don't want to flip out and just live in a bubble. We have to teach our kids how to navigate the world. But I think that navigation means we're maintaining that attachment to them much longer by decreasing the amount of influence that social media and the media technology is having on them that is the main driver in pulling them away.
Yes, I think so too. He really nailed it. Taking that, you know, just taking the family back. The other thing too is just he talked about being that voice in their life too, really challenging and saying no to things. You know, we found that, you know, we end up seeing a lot of FD sisters of kids that came out younger. You know, the parents had more time to work with their children than be that voice in their life. And there was tension in the home, you know, at times too, there was pushback. But in those cases, as long as it's done in love, you know, they continued to challenge their kids in these areas. We did see where the children recognized that they were on the wrong path. They could see how much their parents loved them, and there was healing in the family. And I think that's so important. I lost track of the other thing that he had in there too, but there was so much wisdom in what he said there. I think, and go ahead.
Oh yeah. And then he was talking about how it's so hard, especially for males, to come back, and they're so kind of ostracized after so many years of, you know, demasculating themselves. And I think that's why we need to lead with a massive amount of humility. You know, it takes a lot of humility for them to say, this was wrong and I was wrong, and these years have kind of been wasted, and I was demanding something that you could never give me. It's like, that takes so much humility. We need to meet them with that level of humility, and we should have that level of humility when we know Jesus and know that we are wretched sinners who deserve nothing, but it's by God's grace that we are here. And so we want to, you know, lead with humility, and we want to raise our kids so that they see humility in us, and that they can talk to us, and we're working through them with hard things. They see Jesus changing our own lives too.
Oh yes, absolutely. I you know, made me think too of you just sharing Andy Stanley's you know, curriculum for the church, North Point. And just in that, just seeing how it's, they're really giving the children the reins, you know, in leading and not, you know, so I think that's a good example of a bad way of going, not taking control of your family or, you know, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that there's so much wisdom we need to have and what that control looks like. You know, a couple of places where we can get off in that is just clamping down on behavior and not actual discipleship of their hearts, raising them in a bubble to where we think that we're protecting them from everything, but they're still not discipleship to have their hearts remade by Christ. And I see all those errors being made at times in families, and I'll meet with parents. They'll say, I did everything I could to protect them from the world. It's like, but what they needed was a transformed heart. So we want to protect them from the world, from social media and all that. And yet we still need to disciple their hearts, have an environment where they can talk about anything. We're helping them process the world. And we're somewhat focusing on what's going on in their heart and not just like clamping down on behavior.
Right. I know my husband would say, you know, just that concern of the performance Christianity, you know, we're just concerned about the performing and not really understanding the heart. And sometimes that can be hard as a parent when we're busy on the training. We want to make sure we're covering all the area and helping them on the right path. But, you know, that we really are intentional on hearing the heart and pressing in and being curious and questioning, why they're making the choices they're making, why they're frustrated or, you know, whatever might be going on in their life, that we just take the time to really hear them out and hear what's going on in their heart.
That leads into my next question of how, as men who have transitioned, you guys often get boxed into two archetypes, either the homosexual who became transsexual, gay effeminate men, or autogynephiles, men with paraphilias. But what do you, as a male detransitioner, think about those two categories? Like, are they too narrow?
I think that, and I haven't read enough, I hope I'm saying his name right, Dr. Blanchard's work. I haven't read enough of it to speak on it extensively. And I think that the work that he was doing in some ways was, you know, before I criticize it, I think I'd like to say that it's very fearless in some ways, because I think he took a lot of flack for that work. And he, you know, was easily, you know, cast out of a lot of circles for that work. And him daring to ask questions about it, I think was very important. I definitely think that autogynephilia exists. I mean, I myself would say pretty confidently that even as a fellow transsexual, you know, woman, so to speak, I was, you know, preyed upon by people who I would very squarely put in the autogynephile category in ways that were, you know, very innocuous all the way to straight up, you know, sexual violence. And those people certainly exist. A lot of them admit, even they go so far as to admit it. You know, some of them don't, but it's very obvious in their behavior. I don't know as much about his homosexual archetype, to be honest with you, but I it seems, from what I do know about it, it seems reasonable that that exists too. All I will say though about categories outside of maybe his is that I think that there is a growing number of transitioners. Of males in particular, maybe females as well, but I'm not, you know, a doctor enough to comment on that, but that it is much more about escapism rather than towards running towards a thrill, right? If I wanted to use an analogy of substance abuse, right? You know, people talk a lot about substance abuse, some people who use it being for escapism, right? Like this kind of classic art, this kind of like classic stereotype of a guy drinking because he wants to forget this horrible thing he'd done in his life, or he's having a very hard time in life. I think there's a lot of that in male transitioners. I think there's a ton of it because there were very few, if any, moments for me where transitioning was an enjoyable proposition. And I knew a lot of people like that. Our lives as and our conversations as two transgender identified males literally consisted of telling each other what was male about our faces or our bodies and telling each other what we thought of we could do to fix that. None of it was in many of these conversations was about sexual gratification, even in the least. It was misery of our own body sex. And I think that warrants some research of what that is and what that really isn't. I'm not a psychologist, but I think that does exist outside of his categories for sure.
Sure. And I mean, while I think that those two categories do apply to a lot of people, I feel like people like you who are in it for the escapism are often overlooked and like unfairly blamed or accused of being either one of those things.
I think there's truth to that. My only caveat would be that I think that in transition, and I don't want to speak for everyone, but for many people I know and for myself, transitioning, a great deal of it composes of hurting other people. and is composed of harming innocent people. And my behavior, at the very least, was many times completely unacceptable throughout this process. And
how so?
You know, I was a hedonistic, lecherous person. My sexual relationships with people were not healthy. My relationships with women were not positive or acceptable. My views sexual relationships between other people were not within what I would call acceptable boundaries. And, you know, that's not to take a beating to myself or anything, but I think this lifestyle, when you live just based on what feels good next, you inevitably are going to hurt other people. And so I think that even if in people, you know, like me, or if that is what I'm like or not like me, there are always traces of the more harmful parts of like what Dr. Blanchard's like autogynephilia and the things that we see running throughout it that are inevitable in the life of the transgender identified male.
You talked about how, I mean, you and I personally even have extensively talked about how through our transitions we hurt our own family.
Linda, before we go on, and they're going to talk more about, you know, the harm to the families, you made such a strong point on just the escapism. You know, mentioned a couple of kind of psychological disorders, and we don't have probably the bandwidth to get into those today, but we see so much transgenderism that's about escaping of, I don't like who I am, or I don't like these circumstances. And, you know, like the especially the Caucasian male boy who, like, it's looked down upon to be a white male in our culture, so they can escape that. Girls who are insecure about their bodies, which is like every girl, because it's like hard. Puberty is hard, and make all these transitions. And what they're told is that if you are uncomfortable with your body, then here's a solution. You can escape that uncomfortableness. And it's like, no, like, we need to shepherd them through in a healthy way. But I think all of us who are involved in this world a lot see so much escapism of, this is not doing anything positive or good. It is trying to escape something that felt uncomfortable or, you know, just displeasurable.
Oh, absolutely. And I really appreciated his transparency, too. You know, he wasn't quick to latch on to excuses. You know, he admitted to his own path, you know, and where it leads, recognizing that, you know, it is a dark place, and it can get to be darker and darker depending on how far down that path you go. So, there are propensities, you know, like you mentioned too, there are different, you know, the transsexual, the transvestite, the autogynephile, but, you know, even with that understanding, I'm lost a train of thought here. I lost it.
That's okay.
Cut out here.
We'll put that on the blooper reel.
Yeah, right. Oh, there was something in that. I really appreciated his transparency, though, not making excuses for sin. And, you know, really kind of shedding light on, too, once you go down that path where it can lead, you know, when you kind of do wonder, when does the prey become the predator, right? You know, some of these individuals that he's talking about that are predators, you know, you do wonder, how did they start out? Where was the first step in their life, you know, as they went down this path?
And, you know, like they've always said, like, most people who are abusers were once abused themselves. And you go from being the prey to the predator. And I see so much that with the transgender ideology, some of them not like, you know, child predators, like maliciously, but like they truly think that they're helping someone by helping someone along in this process, you know, and at some point they are going from being the prey to being another predator.
And it's clear how even though you tried your best to push them away, they still cared about you and they still fought for you. Do you think that down the line that there's anything that they could have actually done or said that could have potentially prevented this?
I think I speculate that limiting exposure to social media, in particular in the internet, and paying more, I mean, they paid a lot of attention to it, more than I sadly see a lot of parents nowadays pay attention to at all, but limiting exposure to people in my life who they, you know, who very suspicious signs about could be discerned. But limiting internet exposure unsupervised would have been key. There's no doubt about that in my mind. But I think the key thing that they did, and I think my parents kind of are proof of, is that saying no to your kids is I'm not a parent yet, but maybe the most important thing you can do in some ways is saying no to your kids. Saying yes to your kids, I think, is easy, right? Saying yes, let's go get ice cream, you know, 8 times a week would be great, right? But like, you can't do that. Because if you're just going through every whim of your child, you're going to hurt them and turn them into a, you know, I think, you know, I'm not a parent, but I think a narcissist eventually, and I think into a person who is just controlled by whim. You know, I think they call it, I think, like, you know, if I remember right from my limited psychology classes, I think Freud calls it the devouring mother, just saying yes, 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 and not saying, you know, this whim isn't healthy, so we're not going to do that, right? And my parents didn't just have like my whims to deal with, right? My parents weathered societal hatred towards them for doing this and like moral pressure that what they were doing was somehow wrong by not caving to me, and their own child is angry at them. I mean, they had every reason in the world to say, you know what, we're just going to do this because you want to, right? Because we love you, right? And that's the most nefarious part of the trick. So I think in terms of what other parents can do to stop it is like, you have to say no to the world and to these doctors and to your kids. You have to say no, because I love you enough, I'm going to protect you from this. Because I love you, I am going to say no.
Linda, you see so many parents having to navigate that, where there's so much pressure from society, from doctors, from their own children. And many times when they say no to something that's going to harm their child, they're ostracized and they're hated. And so how do we navigate that as parents?
Yeah, it's such a tough one. I mean, when I look back with our story, you know, when you see how distressed your child is, and, you know, we knew our child was struggling, and, you know, and when you see how much they are putting hope in this being a solution, and to have to say no, for us, since it was so early and we didn't know much about transgenderism in 2014, you know, we asked, just give us time to get, you know, to figure this out. We want to do what's best for you and what's best before God. And so, you know, we were given a little bit of time in that we didn't have as much pressure from culture, but, once we tried to ask questions, then we recognized that the pressure was really there, that there was no asking questions, that was dangerous, we were being unsafe. You are in a really hard place. You do kind of feel gaslit in a way. You know, it's like everything around you is telling you should say yes. But, you know, if you have an understanding of the Word of God too, and you know God's creational order, and, you know, it's, you know that this isn't truth, and you can't go along with that. And, you know, and you're up against well-educated people, medical communities that are telling you this is the right thing. And, so yeah, it's very difficult. And I think it's a really difficult thing to do on your own. That's why I really encourage people to press into their, you know, to their small groups, or, you know, people within their church that they, you know, they can go to for support. And if they can reach out to, you know, and finding people in a support group too that can just help them to continue to speak truth into their life. They need to hear truth, because the lies that are coming at them can be so overwhelming at that time. So that support is really important for them at that time.
I think is a very difficult virtue to master. Almost impossible, I think, in some cases.
It's admirable. For sure.
Yeah.
Some people would still even argue that you you're still transgender, you only detransitioned because you had forces like your parents who were trying to push you out of it and socially pressure you socially out of it. How do you respond to those people?
A lot of those same people, from my personal experience, would also say that I was never transgender at the same time, which is just very to kind of, you know, laugh at it for a second. I think it's very paradoxical, but to engage with them seriously, and hopefully in some good faith, I'd like to say that, like, you can ask anyone in my life, I experienced gender dysphoria, if you want to call it that, or discomfort with my sex, to an extent that it was literally driving me closer to suicide, either indirectly or directly. It was ruining my relationships with people 100%. It was causing me to be violent towards myself and others. I mean, there were incalculable tolls from this mental illness that I was suffering from. And today, the only things that I am, you know, if they would want to call it repressing, are, you know, these looking back on these terrible, terrible times and things. And today I think I look around and I love being who I am, you know? And I'm not saying I love myself completely or that I'm perfect or that I'm this great person, but I love the fact that God made me as I am. And I could never say that before. I was furious at God that he would think, oh, I'm, you know, I thought he must have made a mistake. And today I've never thought that once. And to those people that might, you know, see me doing this and think that it's for some outside pressure, my parents couldn't pressure me out of it when I was 14. I was a lot more obstinate back then. If they couldn't pressure me then, you know, I'm a lot more obstinate now, I'd say, you know, as an adult. Like, and I have a lot firmer convictions in some ways now. And if they couldn't pressure me out of it, you know, then, like, they couldn't pressure me into it now, you know? And, yeah, I think it's just like, look at the difference of my life is what I would say to those people, of how miserable I was back then and how happy I am now. If I was really just this undercover, you know, transgender identified male, in their narrative, I would still be, I'd be suffering just unbelievable mental consequences. But it's the complete opposite of the narrative. Today, not engaging in any gender medicine whatsoever, gender psychology, gender whatever, transgender lifestyle, I'm living a better life than I ever have.
Amen. I mean, it seems like...
And Linda, that's just typical of our world, because our world does not want to acknowledge that people like us exist, because it undermines their credibility and what they've put their hope in and some of the lies they believe, that, like, we have no choice in this. And I get that all the time. People who say that either, I'm still just a closet gay man, or that I was never gay to begin with. It's one of those two things, because me living a redeemed and restored life undermines the lies that they've built their own lives on, which is that this is the way we are. We have no choice, and nothing could ever be different.
Right. His testimony of his life, and it certainly sounds like some true happiness. You know, so often we hear that, the transitioners are happier, but, you know, when you hear from families, you know, how their lives are going and what's going on in their lives, it's usually not the case. And so, you know, we can lie to ourselves too, you know, and make it sound like everything is going well. But, you know, as he said, he was constantly pursuing that next thing. You know, he never really was finding true joy.
I mean, the pain that and the agony that you're going through during that time, it's such a jump from the way that you are now. And even, I would argue, and correct me if I'm wrong, the pretty much peaceful childhood that you were living before that point.
Absolutely. My life today somehow is much more like than I was when I was a small child than when I was like a younger adult.
And there are these forces that are subverting all of that and leading you to believe that living somewhere like living the nice life that that you had in the valley was something terrible, that you were something, that there was life to be lived beyond that, that you were bigger than that.
Mm-hmm. I think that transgenderism made the same promise to me that the snake made to Adam and Eve. You know, that there was this knowledge of good and evil that I was somehow just ignorant to. But I think living with the family that I was blessed enough to have, I knew what good was better than many people, especially these people hurting kids, you know?
So as we move on from this, what are you looking forward to later on in life?
Today, I'm looking forward to continuing like the great, genuine friendships that I've developed with, you know, people like you and my friends that I have today that are the like truest friends I've ever had. I have a relationship with a very lovely woman that I'm looking forward to continuing. My relationship with my family, which is better than maybe it's ever been since, you know, I was a very young kid, like you mentioned. And, you know, future careers, future opportunities that I was barred from. And, in particular today, I'm recently had news that I'm going to be looking forward to becoming a father of my own child, which I never thought would be possible.
I'm so happy for you.
Thank you.
That's the best news.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
And I'll be praying for the health of the mother of your child, and I'll be praying for your new growing family.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. I appreciate the prayers, too. I need all of them I can get sometimes.
Are you ever worried about the experiences of your past affecting your life with your family or the way that you're going to raise your child?
Absolutely. I think I've overcome a lot of the, I don't even want to say I've overcome them. God has freed me from a lot of the personal defects that led and were contributing to my ongoing suffering and, you know, that life that I was sort of telling you about. But I think in terms of how I'm going to handle my child's relation to and my, you know, my relationship with my family and everyone I know to this new world, this kind of strange new world that we live in, there are things that, you know, I told you about keeping them away from certain things that I want to, but to be very frank, I feel very nervous about my child's future in this world and their potential for indoctrination and their potential for harm at the hands of these people who are, I think we're seeing kind of an ebb of their sort of influence over society, particularly in the United States right now, but I don't think we've seen their last peak. And I think protecting my family and people protecting our families and our country from that will be, there will be an extremely high cost to pay, I think. And I hope that we're all ready to pay it.
I think you're absolutely right about that. I think that not necessarily the left, but these evil subversive forces that we've been dealing with in the shadows, we haven't seen the last of them yet. They're in remission. But I think that this is a spiritual battle that is going to continue for a very long time, and we have to be equipped to deal with it.
Absolutely. And I think today, even as I sit, you know, in this room, you know, today as I like sit with you in this room talking to you about these things, like I think about the child right now who's walking into a doctor's appointment to have these things done to them, or into a therapy appointment, or who's walking into a, you know, situation with adult, a sexual situation with predatory adults when they're kids like I was. And I think about all those kids like suffering and adults suffering today, adults who are going to administer themselves poison today and who are going to go out feeling poorly about themselves today in regards to this. And I hope they know that people are thinking about them and their future, and that I want what's best for them, you know, even if we disagree on it, like you said, like left or right, I just want their lives to stop being dominated by evil, whatever you want to call it, you know? And I think that like you were saying, this I want to see a future without pain for these people and for people like us and for people who right now would say they aren't like us at all. I want to see an end to the pain for those people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a very kind message to leave off on. These are people who aren't acting out of pure malice. They're hurting, and they deserve forgiveness. So I thank you for putting yourself out there, for talking about this as painful as it is, and for choosing to let me be one of the first people to help present your story to the world. It means a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Luke.
It means a lot that you gave me the opportunity too. Yeah. Thank you, Chloe.
All right. There we are, Linda. We made it. So it's been such a long marathon today, but if anyone actually makes it to the end of our video, like, God bless you. Like, let me know if you actually make it this far, and I'll throw you a sausage McMuffin or something. So, but I want to just give people some encouragement. You know, at the end there, he said, like, he has fear of this world he's having to raise his child in, and there's a healthy amount of that fear on. We need to know what's happening in our world so we can protect our kids. And yet we don't want to just be overcome with fear. At first, it just popped in my head as he was saying that Psalm 91, starting verse 1, he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. And so we don't want to respond with just fear. We want to have trust in God. And that trust doesn't mean we turn a blind eye to the world. We have to navigate it with our kids while we're trusting in God to do some great work in Him. So do you have any just parting advice on how families can do that?
Yeah. Oh, well, I think, you know, just remembering God's hand is not shortened, right? And we have the word. It's not changing. Times are changing. You know, the word never changes. And I think too that the knowledge that we have now of at least the deception, you know, with this that wasn't there for us at the time that we were, you know, when our son came out, we had no idea that this was going on. So parents are far more informed at this point. And then too, I think with just watching this, I guess what I would love to see is for churches to be better equipped to receive these people too that are in that place of questioning or the detransitioners, especially I think we're going to see a lot of them you know, are we just to kind of ask ourselves, how are we talking about these issues right now? Are we mocking? You know, are we making it sound like every male every trans identifying male is a pervert and a predator trying to get into women's spaces? You know, just not being so black and white with the way we look
Absolutely.
At these issues.
Not being so dogmatic and judgmental, and make sure our churches are a hospital for the sick. And you know, it's what an amazing opportunity we have. In a world full of so much darkness, when people come to the end of themselves, what an opportunity we have to proclaim gospel hope, to welcome them into our churches, into our lives, and not make those assumptions. No, there's people who are, we have to distinguish between the sheep and the wolves, and we protect our flocks from the sheep, from the wolves, but there's a lot of just wounded sheep who are hurting people who need love and grace.
Absolutely. Well said.
All right. Well, people are probably tired of hearing us talk. It's been kind of a marathon. Are there any resources you want to point people to, any encouragement, places that you would send people that might be helpful?
Yeah, I'm just going to say Calibrate. I think that's a good start. Well. You know, it's really, you know, I think it's just important to hear each story first. I have a hard time giving resources because every story, you know, every situation is different, and to be able to help them navigate that with the right resources.
And that's a good encouragement of, like, listen to people, like, sit down, hear their stories, and listen to what's going on in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all right, Linda, It's been a marathon today. I know I'm ready for a nap, and so you probably are too. I don't know if people
I have my untouched coffee. I need.
Yeah, Tito has been back here napping the entire, like, 4 hours, and so he slept through it all, and now it is my turn.
I need to learn from
a little nap.
I need to learn from Tuxedo how to relax, how to be chill.
Yep, in the midst of this conversation. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, everyone, thank you so much for joining us on Calibrate Conversations. We'll see you next time. Make sure you go to calibrateministries.com for more resources. And Linda, thank you so much for taking so much time to just digest and process this and all the work you do in ministering to families and understanding what is going on here.
Thank you. And thank you so much for what you're doing. I sure appreciate it.
Absolutely.